Good morning. Welcome to the March 13th San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors meeting. Please rise and join me in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Madam Clerk, would you read the changes to the agenda, please?
Certainly. Amended items. Item number one is amended by replacing the expense report with one signed by the correct supervisor. Added item to closed session, one pending litigation, A, conference with legal counsel existing litigation, number nine, Southern California Pipeline Construction Incorporated versus San Luis Obispo County Flood Control and Water Conservation District. Requirements of the Brown Act have been posted. Requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement.
Thank you. With that, we'll move on to our consent calendar. And I'll ask if there are members of the public that would like to speak on the consent. I have one request. That's Lindy Owen.
Good morning. Lindy Owen from the Prohibition Zone in Los Osos. The consent item I wanted to speak to was the supervisor's expense report on travels and meetings, and we had asked last week if we could know what the outcome of the meeting to Washington, D.C. that Mr. Gibson and along with Pava Ogren and John Diodati made, and whether they were able to procure any assistance for the people of Los Osos, and if there were any other results from their travels. And I thought that maybe there would be an expense list of how much that cost us. And ultimately,
in the project, there are no specific major events to report out of that expedition.
Very good. And we do have a update on the Los Osos wastewater project coming later this month. So, with that, I'll entertain a motion on the consent.
So moved as amended.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded that we approve the consent calendar. Madam Clerk, roll call, please.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes.
Mr. Hill.
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
And Mr. Patterson?
Yes. Okay, we'll go to public comment on items not on the agenda. I have a number of requests to speak. On public comment, we'll begin with Gwen Taylor, followed by Julie Tacker.
Good morning. My name is Gwen Taylor, and I'm a resident of Los Osos in the Prohibition Zone. Having asked the board to place a moratorium on development in Los Osos before, I am asking this once again. For any future development or permits issued for development, be withheld until the ISJ has been adjudicated and the conditions of the ISJ have been implemented. We've not heard anything, nor do we know if any of the requests for implementation has been made. There needs to be a hydrologist review as to the advance of the salt water into our basin. The rain that helps the basin to replenish has been lacking, definitely. And there are no reserves for the community to fall back on. The ISJ agreement signed by the purveyors does not address the cost of the agreement as it continues to escalate for those in the prohibition zone. The draft report of water demands for the prohibition zone was distributed April of 2011. Almost 1 year ago, the community continues to use the water and the water demand analysis report with the needed corrections submitted to Public Works, as well as the numbers of corrected assumptions in the 2011 report, need to be updated. They have not, as of yet. The models need to be reused because they were, shall we call it, questioned by the peer review. Have they been done? Is that report available? As the board denies any action, the loss of our basin continues with numerous consequences, all very, very costly. Do not repeat former board's inactions on behalf of the community of Los Osos. Every day that you put this off, every week that you put this off, it continues to exacerbate the problem. Do something now. Don't do it when it's too late. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Julie Tackert, followed by Ben DeFada.
Good morning. I am Julie Tacker from Los Osos. And today I brought the draft recycled water management plan for the wastewater project to show you. This was submitted to the Coastal Commission sort of quietly. I had to actually get my copy from them. This was submitted in November, and here we are in March. Month after month, citizens from Los Osos have been attending RAC meetings asking that the RAC, a very likely body of bright individuals who are very versed in water, ask that the RAC take up this document and pick it apart. Maybe I'm missing something. Within the document, we're talking about serving treated wastewater to farmers, to schools, and there are shortcomings. There's water conservation measures in here. We thought we had a budget for $5 million for water conservation for Los Osos. It appears that about only half of it will actually go to appliances that save water. So when we asked month after month that the RAC take the item up, we were very happy to see that maybe in March, this last week, they would hear the item and maybe form a subcommittee, maybe actually hash through this item. I should have known the moment I read this ambiguous agenda item. On it since 2007. So sometime long after the permit for the wastewater project, we might have a groundwater management plan to pair with this and discuss. But I think it was very embarrassing for poor Courtney, and I think very disappointing for the rest of us. And I think your board should ask the RAC to take this item
up.
Thank you,
Ms. Tacker. Ben DeFada.
Good morning, Chairman Patterson, board.
Excuse me, Ben, one second, please. Followed by Mike Brown. Okay, take it away.
Good morning, Chairman Patterson, board, public, and sheriff. I am Ben DeFada from the little poor town of Los Osos. As if there isn't enough suffering in the world here in this county, we have one caused by Mr. Gibson's lack of common sense. For instance, shame on you all for the continued problems in the case of Sunny Acres. Mr. Duvall is about to lose his property because of this county's regulations against his 72-acre farm that has been there for 70 years. He is trying to take care of people who have addiction problems at very reasonable rates to this county. He gives them therapy and a work program for those that are working on his farm and even pays them to boot. He has a good record of success with these people. Otherwise, the county would not send him people with problems. He has shelter on his property that's better than sleeping under bridges and creek beds. These people built these little cabins to keep the cold off their bones and safety from two and four naked critters. Don't tell me you can't bend the rules a little. For this, he asked no money from the county for helping other human beings. You all think about doing something for the homeless every year, but when winter is over, the homeless and the addicts are forgotten. This goes on every year. In Los Osos, it's been 4 to 5 years when the county took over the sewer project. Mr. Gibson even had his shovel-ready project ready to go. Instead, he still continued to spend over $10 million more on more studies. only to see Mr. Gibson and his staff dragging their heels with his overpriced, unaffordable, energy hog, not-so-green, deep trench pipes buried in streets in a town built in a liquefaction sand dune zone with three major seismic earthquakes faults under it. This $200 million gravity project will continue to stink even if you covered it with gold. We can save $50 to $100 million with a better and cheaper alternative. $200 to $300 a month is asking too much for at least 3,000 property owners for this sewer project. That's over $3,000 or more a year of discretionary money that will cause an economic ripple throughout this county. It's a big energy hog, and all levels of government is asking everyone to save energy and water, not waste it. It's been a year since the Japanese tsunami and their atomic energy power plant. I'll be skipping, running out of time. 20,000 lives died, and many more are still missing. An article in the Tribune last Sunday quotes plant manager Jim Becker, which said, quote, "You learn from mistakes and you make improvements based upon experience," end of quote. Gentlemen, all we need is one mistake, be it man-made or natural disaster, and we are all toast. Gentlemen, it's a no-brainer. One event and it's over. Has common sense left this building, or was it ever here? Convert the plant to natural gas and let's go on with life. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeFatta. Mike Brown, followed by Bob Blair.
Mike Brown representing CoLab. As you know, tomorrow, Wednesday, March 14th, is the hearing by the Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board on the so-called agricultural water discharge order. Clearly, the board is, at least the chairman and the staff, are ready to move forward. They have banned any further written comment, limited public comment to 2 minutes, and have a very strong staff recommendation for adoption and a rejection of the agricultural community's counter proposals. The issue is that they're trying to divide and conquer the various communities. So tomorrow it will primarily focus on people who grow row crops in larger amounts, lettuce, broccoli, cauliflower. But people shouldn't be deceived, because once that's in place, they're going to come for the smaller units, they're going to come for wine, they're going to come for everything else, and eventually they're going to come around and come for the municipalities and the counties as well. So I know you have the Waste Management Board in the afternoon, but if you guys could get over there, and I'm sure, knowing that you have official duties in the afternoon, they would let some of you speak and protest against the adoption of the order, and to request that it be sent back to staff.
What part of federal law don't you understand? Federal law rules. Until the federal law is straightened out, these people can't have marijuana clinics. And a marijuana clinic needs to be in a pharmacy. It's a drug. It's a controlled drug. It needs to be with the other controlled drugs, not sold out of an old beat-up house in Oceano. The other thing I'd like you to consider is voting for the project of drilling for oil in the WASDA. I know this is a controversial project, but we need oil and gas in this country. If diesel fuel goes much more over $5 a gallon, you're going to see your food prices go right through the roof. They're already rising. Fuel prices in this country are going through the roof, and we're using a lot of times the wrong type of fuel. You look at the back of a Chevy truck, it says flex fuel. Flex fuel is 70% ethanol, 30% gasoline. Take 6 gallons or more of diesel to make 1 gallon of flex fuel. There's only 2 stations in all of California that sell flex fuel. So where are you going to get this wonderful stuff to run in these cars? You go to Europe, you don't see any Chevrolets, because all the cars in Europe, 80% are diesel. 3 of the cars I own in Europe have 4-cylinder diesels in them. They get 55 miles per gallon, have all the performance of any 6-cylinder engine sold in the United States. We need to get our fuel together. We need to make sure that we're using the right fuel. Natural gas is a fuel that's used throughout a lot of the world. We're not using that. We have lots of it. I know you can't do much about it, but maybe a vote for drilling for fuel and oil and gas in the WASDA might help. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Blair. Eric Greening, followed by Lindy Owen.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and the previous speaker mentioned the Acceleron project, which the Planning Commission took staff recommendation and denied. It will probably be coming your way on appeal. There is a broader context that I hope you will investigate while you're waiting for that appeal to come forward, and that is that the Monterey Shale is becoming increasingly prominent in terms of future speculation, and so any decision you make there will be the pattern you set, the precedent you set for how you are going to implement our new conservation and open space policies, 7.1 and its implementations 1 through 25, 7.2 and 7.3. You can show that they mean what they say they mean, or you can give a signal that much bigger projects, much bigger applications that are very likely coming in the near future can use as a precedent and say, "This, see how you meant it here?" To get an idea of how big it is, I sometimes, you know, as a low-income person, you wouldn't think I would be reading investor publications, but part of vigilance in terms of what's coming to this county is occasionally I visit Google and Google words like investment, Monterey Shale, and see what pops up. And something quite startling popped up recently. There's a publication called Money Morning. Their slogan is, "Only the news you can profit from." On February 28th, there was an article basically saying the Monterey Shale was going to be bigger than the California Gold Rush of 1848, and that Occidental, just one of the players, Occidental, is planning to invest $6.2 billion in the Monterey Shale in the next 4 years. Now, I didn't see a breakdown, and I haven't in further research been able to find a breakdown by county, but obviously we are in the center of a multi-county formation of Monterey Shale. And the message is that this is a huge thing. Some would say, well, if people are going to invest here, that's good for the economy. But it's worth studying what happens to our current economic drivers, agriculture and tourism, in the presence of major oil development, because it isn't good for either of them. In any event, there is a broader context to an individual project you will be seeing in the next couple of months, and I strongly encourage you to investigate that context. And I think a greater need than burning the oil right away is leaving it in the ground until our carbon dioxide is below 350 parts per million and leave it for future generations to use. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Lindy Owen, followed by Al Barrow.
Good morning again, Lindy Owen from the Prohibition Zone in Los Osos. I would have to agree. What's more important, fuel and profit or water? We kind of can't live without the water, so I totally hope that you will take a look at fracking and the damage that it does, and it's mostly short term. What I wanted to speak to today is about intervention, and I'm not putting names on any elected representatives who are going to build the right sewer for us. And then the county, then Mr. Blakesley decided to take it away, gave it to the county. The county, eventually it landed in Pava Ogren's lap, and he began a two-year process, which was absolutely ludicrous because the process was already in front of us. It was to compare two systems. Instead, we wasted those 2 years. We're 6 years along on this project, and we're millions and millions of dollars into studies with no future end in sight that I can see. The project is going to have cost overruns that are going to shock everyone that is faced with the idea of what we're going to have to pay for a sewer for 5,000 homes. New studies show that we don't even need the sewer for that many homes. We could be doing a phase system. We could be doing the correct collection system, which is the flexible piping. and keeping a septic tank, and you could solve this whole problem and be done with it within a year. We could have done this 6 years ago. So we have 180 conditions. According to the Coastal Commission, there have been none of them met as of yet. Some of those conditions are highly expensive, like taking these big, giant gravity pipes and making them secure for an earthquake, if there is such a thing as making them secure, with a lurching that will probably go on under Los Osos because of the liquefaction zone. We probably, those extra costs probably won't even help. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. Al Barrow.
Good morning. Thank you, board, members of the public. I'm Al Barrow, Coalition for Low-Income Housing. Today I would like to present you with a well-deserved award. I have watched many of you give awards over this period of public comment, watching what you do to other people. I think it's time now to give you your deserved award. So this is called the Golden LeMay Toilet Paper Award. I give this to you in the spirit of good-heartedness because you have created the most expensive sewer in America, 10 times what other Californians pay for Los Osos sewer, a $40,000 per home cost. For your perspicacity and audacity, above and beyond the call of duty, we present this Gold LeMay Toilet Paper Award, if I may.
One to you, Bruce. One to you, Adam.
Thank you.
Yours, it's all right.
I hope this is Charmin.
I'm sorry?
I hope it's Charmin.
And it's very soft.
We like the soft color.
I know you're going to enjoy wiping with this.
We'll think of you.
At any rate, some astounding feats that your board and staff has accomplished. November, the notice of violations that were sent out to the voters before the 218 vote, and your partnership with Water Nazi Briggs, who either vote yes or lose your home threat. That was before the $25,000 assessment. The PR spin from your experts in San Diego on septic versus gravity, the shovel-ready lie to the Coastal Commission, the head fake to the USDA on the liar loan application, not telling them liquefaction, earthquake conditions exist, and even when their representative Ron Malthus, USDA Representative Washington, toured the site, he was not told. The Ferguson lobby, the CAPS tour in the Bay Mud, the affordable project, mostly USA, the vacant properties make the profits and pay nothing. It goes on and on. So I want to thank you very much for all your time and effort on this, and if I had more paper, I give it to your staff, too. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Barrow. That concludes our general public comment this morning, so I'll close it to general public comment and move along on our agenda to item number 8. Madam Clerk, would you introduce that item, please?
Item number 8, a presentation on emergency planning and readiness activities.
Good morning.
Mr. Alsop, are you going to? Oh, Mr. Buckshot.
Yeah, good morning. Dan Buckshot, Assistant CAO. Just a brief intro for this item. The intention is to provide an update on the status of our emergency planning and readiness. Mr. Alsop,
that we had underway as of March 11th, 2011, and how those tie into what we're doing. So what we're going to do today is talk briefly. I'm going to try and make it a brief presentation. As many of you know, we have a 6-page staff report that contains more information. That we'll put that on our website as well as the presentation today on our website later today or hopefully by the end of the day today. So the earthquake planning, tsunami, And then we're going to concentrate a little bit on our nuclear power plant emergency planning update. As you can see there, evacuation times estimate and how that ties in. Plume monitoring enhancements, which we'll explain a little bit more, too, when we get to that. Ingestion pathway zone, which is our 50-mile, basically agriculture-type hold zone and related aspects. And then just by happenstance, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Federal Emergency Management Agency had been for a number of years working on some new regulations for emergency planning requirements at nuclear power plants. We'll touch on those. Other projects, and then, of course, some lessons learned, and then also how we deal with training, our emergency drills, and exercises. And first off, for the earthquake update, obviously we all know, but we had a Japan had a 9.0 magnitude earthquake, a very serious earthquake. I believe it, if I recall correctly, one of the fourth largest earthquakes that we've had in the known history of the world. Was centered in a subduction zone. Fortunately for us, we're not subject to subduction zones nearby, so our locally developed tsunamis would certainly not be of the impact that they had in Japan. And, of course, for tsunamis that occur a long distance away, as we saw with the Japanese earthquake, and we get the number of hours of warning. Building and infrastructure essentially performed as designed for the earthquake, and as we also know, majority of the damage was due to the tsunami. The bottom bullet there resulted in secondary hazards, including tsunami, power outage, and dam failure. And one of the things that we learned by looking at the Japanese earthquake is basically reaffirm the importance of how our earthquake plan is outlined, how we have it developed, and what we would initially respond to. In that second bullet there, the emphasis on secondary hazard awareness, infrastructure checks, roads and bridges, the Japanese earthquake essentially verified that we have our order, our priority straight, and what we will do immediately after an earthquake. In their case, they had, unfortunately, among all the other catastrophic damage, a dam failure that did cause fatalities and quite a bit of property damage. In our earthquake plan, our very first priority, once we're in place, is to check the status of the dams in the county. If there's dam failure, particularly three of the dams, could cause significant damage very quickly. So looking at the dams, the roadways, and our backup, how communications fare, basically affirm that the earthquake plan we have in place is adequate. In fact, a quick side note to that is that after the 2003 San Simeon earthquake, we did not make any changes to our earthquake plan. It's pretty static plan. So fortunately for us, it's been verified that, that's a good plan that we have in place. The final bullet there, the incorporation of earthquake analysis into our evacuation times estimate, and we'll tie that in a little later when we talk about that briefly, the evacuation times estimate, which in simple terms is a document, very involved document, that gives us guidance on how long it would take to evacuate the area, protective action zones around Diablo Canyon in case we needed to do so. It gives us some guidance on how long it would take under various circumstances. But we had this update going on for a number of years, a few years, and the timing of it's in conjunction with the census. So the 2010 census, of course, gives us updated population information. And in our case, before we updated it, we requested PG&E to do a study, actually Caltrans, and we in the County Office of Emergency Services requested PG&E to do an earthquake analysis on a study and run some scenarios and get some actual engineered estimates. What would happen after, in this particular case, we ran a 7.2 earthquake on the Hostry, severe rain, and what would happen to the roadways. So we got that study, and that's being incorporated into the evacuation times estimate that we'll talk about in a little bit. As for the tsunami, we did make a few changes to our tsunami plan. As we're all aware, we had, time estimate, we had about 6 or 7 hours to come across. It's on the slide there, but we won't go into that. 6 to 7 hours, 8 hours of notice before we would be impacted by the tsunami. We did receive a tsunami warning. The West Coast and Alaska Tsunami Warning Center, and we had a projection that two of the areas that might have key damage were, no surprise, up in Del Norte County, and also they specifically noted Port San Luis. So we activated our Emergency Operations Center. As we all know, we did evacuations, activated the Emergency Alert System, used reverse 911 to make notifications to the folks. So the one change we made to our tsunami plan afterwards was incorporating our emergency alert system messages. We made some changes on those, incorporated them into a format that we can more easily use in reverse 911. And we also, just followed up on the Japanese tsunami and just basically, as you can see in some of these bullet points here, I won't go through them one by one. But some folks didn't heed evacuation orders, and, of course, that always causes some considerable problems even here in our own state. Up in Northern California, one person was a bit too close to the shoreline and unfortunately was washed out and killed. Debris became a secondary hazard, and on the note of the debris, we'll talk about the what's being. We don't anticipate that that would be a radiological hazard since it was washed out to sea prior to the nuclear power plants having their accidents in the release. But it is being tracked across the Pacific. It looks like at this point that it will primarily have an impact in the northern states, north of us, Oregon, up into Washington, Alaska, and Canada. It doesn't look like it's going to impact us too much. Nonetheless, you know, we're still tracking it. As you can see in the top of bullet point there, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration is the lead on that. So it is something that we'll be following. It's anticipated debris may hit Hawaii soon, spring, which, of course, is coming up here very promptly, and then sometime along our west coast in about 2013 or so. But we'll keep an eye on that as it gets closer, and we'll continue monitoring and planning as necessary. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Kelly Van Buren for nuclear power plant planning updates.
So, of course, we have quite a few nuclear power plant updates that we can talk about since we saw you guys last year. And just to start with a few descriptions, so the areas that you guys know what we're focusing on. The emergency planning zone, it's the area directly surrounding a commercial nuclear power plant. So all nuclear power plants in the United States have these. The federal requirement is a 10-mile radius around the plant. San Luis Obispo County and the state adopted an expanded area to allow to do more extensive planning, more extensive training, not because Diablo is any less safe than the other power plants. So ours actually extends 18 by 22 miles. So you'll see that elongated shape there. And this area is further broken down into protective action zones, which really help us planning and help in evacuations and kind of break it up into smaller pieces. The public education zone is we're unique in the country. This is an area that extends even further outside of the emergency planning zone by a few miles, and it just provides public information to those people, residents, and businesses that live in those areas. So there's no protective actions that are expected for those individuals, but they're given the information because they do live in the vicinity of the emergency planning zone. So you'll see those are the gray circles that kind of outline the emergency planning zone shape. The ingestion pathway zone, or IPZ, is an approximate 50-mile radius that circles a nuclear power plant. And that ingestion pathway zone is further segmented into agricultural areas, somewhat like PAZ, so that we can break them into smaller pieces and work with them easier. And the idea there is if there were a plume, we need to make sure that we're taking proper precautions for food and water supplies in those areas, because that's really the long-term consequences of a nuclear emergency, is making sure that you can deal with that and people aren't continuing to ingest contaminated food or water products. In those areas, we would have to do testing to make sure that the food and water supplies are safe. And so early on, they'd be held and quarantined. It's a long process that the state and locals have plans to deal with to make sure that there's ways to test those food products before they're let back out into the food supply. Also, as Ron mentioned, we have the evacuations time estimate, the ETA for short. We love our acronyms. It is an estimate, basically, of time required to evacuate the general public. It also takes into consideration access and functional needs in different scenarios, you know, summer, seasonal, and when weekend versus weekday. So we try to look at all different aspects to try to figure out the best guess of how long an evacuation would take. It is a very extensive study, and it produces a pretty lengthy document that decision makers can use to basically make sure their evacuation decisions are appropriate and that we're not evacuating people into traffic that they can't escape from and they're just stuck there like sitting ducks. So it's a document that is extremely useful to us in our community. It is in the process of being updated based on the 2010 census, and it should be done within the next couple months. We also had additional scenarios with earthquakes, as Ron mentioned, brought into it so that we can consider a little bit more different situations and scenarios. And San Luis County and Diablo are very proactive in making sure that this document is updated ahead of regulations, not just waiting until we're required to do it. So if there are changes, population increases, anything along those lines, we're going to make sure that it is a document that is effective for us. plume monitoring. So we have also been doing quite a few changes, and this was, it predates Fukushima. But plume monitoring software and capabilities are essential for radiological emergencies. Plume modeling allows basically decision makers to focus on who's going to be affected so that we can make protective actions for those groups effectively and efficiently. There were significant enhancements made over the past couple of years, and they've recently been completed. It really involves adding more MET towers so they can take data from different MET towers and add it into their analyzing process. So when they're presenting kind of the formal document to us, they say, you know, we looked at this tower, and this tower to get this end result, and not just one tower assuming that the weather doesn't change. We also are updating our agricultural brochure, and that's intended for food producers and farmers and ranchers, just to provide them information, additional information that's really focused on ag, so they know what to do in an emergency. And then we need to coordinate with our neighboring counties, because our 50-mile radius stretches into Kern, Monterey, and Santa Barbara counties. So we have meetings set up with them and with the state of California to really make sure that everybody's on the same page, that our plans are consistent, that everybody knows who's responsible for what. And so that's this a project for this year that we're working on. New federal regulations. So we do have new regulations that were unveiled in the past few months, and the regulations predate Fukushima. They were in the works for 7, 8, 9 years. So they are not taking into consideration new changes that may come out in the next couple years over what happened in Japan. The regulations will be fully implemented by early 2014 here. We've been going to workshops to learn how they're going to affect us. We're in a good situation. Many of our plans already meet the new regulations. We're already kind of doing above and beyond, and so they're bringing up a lot of plants to the level that we're at. So we'll have some changes. It's nothing drastic, but those are going to be the next couple of years. We're going to be working on those. And a summary of the new regulations, they are looking at alert and notification systems, basically our sirens and different ways we alert the public, backup route alerting, facility inspection frequency. They want to come and look at the facilities that we're going to use, want to look more often and make sure that they are up to par. The exercise cycle is changing. They're adding in some different types of exercises that we need to exercise, hostile action and ingestion pathway exercises, so they've changed up the cycle a little bit. They also want them less, so that people aren't expecting the exercise. They don't know quite what they're going to be faced with when they come to the exercise, and so that's good. They're trying to add in some little challenges. They also want the exercises to be more challenging, more variation in the scenario. Ron will talk about it at the end. We have a slide, but we've already been doing this for years. You know, oh, there's a tsunami, and then by chance Diablo Canyon has an issue. You know, it's a way for us to combine tsunami planning and nuke at once. A lot of plants don't do that, and so now they're actually kind of encouraging plants to do that, to make it a little bit more difficult for their players. So that won't be too much of a struggle for us. And then NIMS and ICS incorporation. We're playing a lot with that and making sure, because the NIMS and ICS was kind of outside of the nuclear power world. So we're trying to bring the two together and make it more smooth, which really helps working with our offsite partners. Additional NPP projects that didn't really fit in our other slides. These are just some other projects we're working on. We're working on redistributing some of our agency responsibilities. You know, county fire and sheriff get tacked on with doing a lot of jobs, but they also have an on-site role, so we need to make sure that we don't give them so many responsibilities that they need to do in the community that they can't also help Diablo in an emergency. So we're looking at how we can pull some of those responsibilities away from them. Hostile action plan changes. Hostile action is a big piece of regulations and making sure that our offsites can adequately help Diablo should there be a security or hostile action event. And so that's a huge piece of what we are incorporating into our plans. We did a drill this past fall to kind of try it out, and so we're going to spend the next 2 years streamlining that. On-site support capabilities. We really want to make sure that what Diablo needs from the county is happening smoothly and efficiently, and whatever that may be, and making sure that there's plans for it. And so we're just kind of getting into that now. Additional field monitoring team. We are adding another county field monitoring team, so that's exciting. We had 3 before, so now we'll have 4 field monitoring teams. Agricultural partner workshops. So like I said, the ingestion pathway zone is changing, so we want to get out and have workshops with our agricultural partners and make sure that they are informed on the changes and the brochures, and they get to put their input into it if they have concerns. And then communication system enhancements. Obviously, communications are a huge part of any emergency, but in Fukushima, there was a a very huge part of not having communication with the offsite partners, even on-site Diab or on-site at Fukushima, they had communication issues. So we really want to focus on that and figure out what we have available. We have a lot more resources than we actually currently plan for. So we want to kind of pull those into our plans. And lastly, recovery plan and enhancement training exercises. Our typical exercises focuses on the emergency phase, and then we kind of call it good and we're done for the day. Well, we really want to take it a next step. You know, okay, so now the plume's done, but what do we do next? Well, there's a lot to do next. Agriculture and reentry, letting people back in temporarily or permanently, and recovery, and how are we going to recover from this? So we want to focus towards the end of this year on recovery planning and making sure we're in a good place with that as well. Post-Fukushima actions. We are participating in formal and informal lesson learned opportunities. Anywhere we can, we're trying to pull in information and reports from what happened there so that we can add changes, recommendations, ideas into our plans if they're not already there. We intend to integrate these plans far ahead of any regulations. Regulations take quite a while to develop and to approve. So if there's good ideas out there, we're not going to wait for that. We're going to start incorporating them when we can. Many of the issues that we've already seen and have heard about are already in.
City police departments wanted to catch their graveyard shift and oncoming day shift at the same time. So RTA training on Sunday afternoons, you know, it's an ongoing process that we do year-round. To put it in further context, we have 5.5 folks, 5.5 people in the Office of Emergency Services. 4.25 of those positions are funded for nuclear power plant training and planning. So this is something that we have ongoing and are doing all the time. And with that said, our annual report that FEMA requires, and we track our training, we put on 5,576 hours of NPP related training, specific training, during calendar year 2011. We have numerous exercises to test our plans and capabilities. Our plans and our exercises are evaluated by FEMA. You know, when we make a plan change, you know, we send that to FEMA for review and comment. Our most recent exercises, we've been fortunate in that FEMA did not identify any areas that that needed corrective action. And the recent exercises over the past few years, as Kelly noted, when we have our nuclear power plant exercises, since we do concentrate so much of our planning on nuclear power plant, we take advantage of that to use the NPP exercises for other training. So some of the scenarios we had in the recent exercises were a tsunami warning, and then, as Kelly mentioned, oops, just coincidentally, a nuclear power plant accident to test ourselves on both. Emergency worker monitoring and decontamination. Evacuee monitoring and decontamination at 2009 was one of the many drills that's evaluated by FEMA that took place up at Camp Roberts. In 2010 was actually quite a challenging exercise. We had a very realistic scenario with a 100-year storm, road closures, roads out, and then the scenario evolved into an emergency at Diablo Canyon with roads blocked, and that was a challenging exercise that that certainly tested us. 2011, we have basically what's referred to as our hospital exercise, train with off-site medical, and then 2011, you can see the earthquake and radiological release. 2011 hostile action, and we keep using that term hostile action. One of the new requirements from both the NRC and then FEMA for us is to have scenarios that are based on a hostile action at the plant. You know, come in there, a terrorist attempt to take the plant over in similar actions, and that's certainly a challenging new scenario for us. And then most recently, in December 2011, evacuee monitoring and decontamination, FEMA evaluated exercise, which they had no findings for us, and this took place at our southern evacuation center, which is the Santa Maria Fairgrounds, or Santa Maria Fair Park, rather. With that, before I turn it over to Mr. Conway for his part of the presentation here, I want to mention that all this planning certainly takes quite a bit of effort on our part, but we're actually a very small part of it. You know, as you can see in the audience here, we have our agriculture commissioner and his outstanding right-hand person there, APCD, Public Works, Environmental Health, the Public Health, Dr. Bornstein's here, County Fire, Sheriff's Department. We have a CHP here, Lieutenant Day. These folks are extensively involved in this. In fact, agriculture has been doing extensive outreach related. We're talking about the ingestion pathway zone. They've already been doing that. And just an example of how all this stuff actually ties together, we were fortunate to use some of our nuclear power plant funding to do aerial photography of the ingestion pathway zone, but various county departments kicked in a few more dollars, so we're actually able to update the aerial photography for the whole county. So this is a process that we're constantly working on, and one of the key findings we're seeing actually coming out of Japan, as Kelly touched on, The communications do not work real well within the agencies, within the government agencies, with the TEPCO had some issues. And the citizens started getting the information, and they were tweeting each other. There was really bad misinformation. I think the strongest lesson learned for us is we really need to enhance our crisis communication here locally. We need to make sure our public that we serve knows what's going on after any emergency, but particularly in this case with a nuclear power plant emergency. And we definitely need to come up with a simpler process to explain to the public during a radiological emergency, including during our drills, what is being released, how much is being released, and we need to do that in simple terms. I think that's some lessons learned. But with that, we also, I want to note that as you can see with our plan and the various participants we have, our nuclear power plant plan is the San Luis Obispo County City's nuclear power plant plan. It's a joint plan that's extremely unique to not only California. San Onofre doesn't operate that way. Theirs is different. They have separate plans for their jurisdictions, but to the United States. To the point, as some of you know, in the lobby upstairs is an award we received in, I think it was 2006, from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency because they realize how unique that is. And we work closely with Diablo Canyon. Our joint information centers where we put out information. And when Diablo occasionally hires somebody from outside the area, outside California, they're surprised to come into our joint information center and know and find out that the county's in charge, the county's lead agency, and many plants, the utilities, are the lead agency for emergency public information at the joint information centers. So we'll continue working hard and pedaling fast and doing the best we can to not only the lessons learned here for Fukushima, but the other aspects of our emergency planning that we demonstrated here today. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Conway for his
yes,
presentation.
Yes, and Mr. Conway, if we can wait just a moment, there are some questions of staff from the board. So let's entertain those questions. Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ron and Kelly, good job. A couple of questions.
Geological monitoring and assessment a team that comes in. It's a federal team. And, in fact, San Onofre had a three-day exercise, and part two of that was to bring in this federal team to do what you're looking at, ingestion pathway, plume monitoring. Well, off they went to Japan. So we rely on that resource. But locally here, we have, we mentioned the field monitoring teams. There are folks that go out and actually work in the plume phase of it. But we also have the three-day-long exercises for ingestion pathway zone exercises. Those don't happen as often as perhaps they could, but actually the state and feds actually come in and set up and pass exercises at Camp San Luis, so we rely heavily on that federal expertise.
Okay, thank you. And another question, if I could, on the evacuation time planning. Obviously, one of the more difficult things that we've talked about and the public has weighed in on is simulating panic, which occurs in reality, and it's hard to in drills to actually simulate it exactly the same way as it occurs, which of course is not very predictable. Were there lessons? I mean, obviously, with the tragedy in Japan, where they had an earthquake and a tsunami, and then the terrible meltdown also of the reactors. I mean, were there instances of information gleaned that help with our evacuation planning as well from that?
Not that we've seen yet from that. That's something that we'll certainly be following up on. But on that note of what how people will react in emerging disasters such as this, we rely on sociologists that actually do this for a living. You know, folks that go around and study, you know, disasters and how people react. That comes into our planning aspect. But we also use specific information, including telephone surveys, to find out what people are planning to do. Now, of course, that doesn't predict what they're going to actually do in a real event. But our main input in emergency planning is pretty extensive sociological input in how people react in disasters. But, of course, we will be following up with Fukushima to see if there can be some lessons learned from that as well.
And then, you know, we did follow the kind of the timeline of evacuations in Japan, you know, and they did, you know, a small area first, and then as it got worse, they did a little larger area and a larger area. And that's very much in line with our evacuation plans. It's very much what we've always planned would happen in a radiological emergency. So I think it kind of validated our planning instead of worrying us. It was, yeah, we could handle that. You know, they went up to 12 miles. The federal requirement is 10, but we're at 18 to 22. So there was nothing in there that panicked us to the fact of, oh, wow, we need to rush out and do some more plans. It's, okay, that's in agreement with what could happen with here.
Well, I wonder, just on that, Kelly, if I could follow up. There is some disagreement on, I think initially the U.S. in terms through its embassy, perhaps in Japan, had ordered all U.S. nationals and so forth to evacuate as far as 50 miles from the center of the incident. And I know that there's that time there's been some disagreement. I wonder if you could comment on that.
We did hear that early on, and the first reasoning was that they felt that they weren't getting the information they needed from the Japanese government. They weren't getting the data, so it was more of a better safe than sorry, let's ask all of our people to go out to 50. Since then, in some reports, it looks like, and I don't know if Ron wants to speak to it, there might be more, more goes along the lines of some incorrect calculations. So I'm not positive we're getting to the bottom of the real story. But
has there been anything from the NRC that would suggest that were they to look back at it now, the U.S. wouldn't recommend a 50-mile?
If they had been confident in the information that they had been given, they said they wouldn't have done it. But they didn't have the information to make an educated decision.
What we are seeing in the initial reports are coming out is questioning that and actually asking the NRC, why did you do that? You know, how did you calculate that?
Right.
So it is something to be followed up on.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm always impressed with the sophistication of our planning efforts, and I know our OAS folks are constantly working to improve that. Supervisor Hill actually asked questions that were on my mind, but following along on the theme of how do we know what's actually going on the ground, you've done your modeling for evacuation times. What's our capability to know actually in an emergency?
What we're finding. Right. So our field monitoring teams, which I said we're adding a fourth one, and that's just for the county. We have Diablo Canyon and joint county field monitoring teams. They are actually going out and trying to find it. And so they will, I call them plume chasers because that seems to make sense to people, but we are picking locations to send them to validate, no, there's nothing there, or validate, yes, there is something there, and then they move to a different location.
Do they also track travel times? I mean, I guess what I'm more, Supervisor Hill asked all the right questions about the radiological issues, but, you know, we're sending people to evacuate down this path, some other path. You know, all risk-benefit calculations there. But we modeled evacuation times. But in an actual emergency, how much do we know about actually how long it's taking to get
PAZ, or these PAZs, a number of them, in this particular scenario? And then, as Kelly noted, CHP goes out there and sets up their traffic control points, being assisted with Caltrans, Public Works, and so on. And so they're constantly out there in the field. I think they would need, if I recall correctly, 100 and some odd officers, which would come over from the Valley and then up down from Monterey and up from Frontera counties.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Supervisor Gibson. I just wanted to ask the two of you, you mentioned that you coordinate both with neighboring counties as well as the state to ensure that they're informed as to what the situation is here and what they may need to do to support us or to essentially address the issues in their counties and or state. Could you just briefly explain how you interface with our neighboring counties and with the state to ensure we have good communication and good coordination?
Sure. The state we're coordinating with on an ongoing basis. We have a gentleman named Mike Warren. I'm sure some of you have met him, and he is down here probably twice a month, meetings, trainings, exercises, coming down here and just making sure that we're on the same page, that our plans are coordinated. The state definitely has a large role in an emergency at Diablo Canyon. Although we deal with the initial couple days, they're going to come in and they pick up pieces of ag and ingestion pathway. So the state has their own plan, and so we have to make sure that our plan and their plan are coordinated. In addition to that, the state actually facilitates coordination amongst the counties. We don't always wait for them to do so. Santa Barbara County, they come up to our meetings. Their OAS department works with us on all sorts of different things, SOPs. We help them write their SOPs and making sure that they're on the right page because we do exercises in their county. So agriculture, Santa Barbara Agriculture and San Luis Agriculture are very close. They talk on the phone. They help each other with planning processes. I would say our planning with Kern and Monterey are not as active. Is much smaller parts of their county that are affected. Kern is very small. Monterey has a bigger piece, and so that's why this year we're really pushing to bring all those together. So we have a meeting set up in April for the three counties, Ag, and their OES departments to come and get together and review our new Ag maps and review the new Ag brochure and get their feedback. Instead of just sending it off to me and saying, please put your stamp of approval, it's really more of working through it and making sure that the public information and mapping are meeting their needs as well.
And if I could add to that, too, in addition to our ongoing interactions with the state, and the state actually represents us with FEMA, but we're fortunate to have a good working relationship. We often interact directly with FEMA as well, is we have quarterly what we refer to as our NPP quarterly meetings. That include California Department of Public Health, California Emergency Management Agency, Santa Barbara County, PG&E, our great environmental health support folks, a number of other people. And then once a year for those meetings, we actually pull in all of the participants. We invite everybody that we work with to come into that. So it's a constant ongoing process. And at state, the California Emergency Management Agency actually has a separate unit. They call it the Radiological Protection Unit for radiological issues. And Kelly mentioned the person's name. We each have our one-on-one contact with somebody that represents us on a day-to-day basis.
Very good. Thank you. That concludes my questions from the supervisors at this point. So I'd like to invite Mr. Conway up, representing PG&E, and I see Tracy Bartis. Are you going to be assisting Mr. Conway? Is that how that's going to work? And Mr. Conway, I do know you have some prepared remarks, but please feel free to respond to any of the questions you've heard or any of the other comments made by staff up to this point.
Thank you, and good morning. I'm John Conway, the Senior Vice President of Energy Supply and Chief Nuclear Officer for Pacific Gas and Electric Company. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to update the Board of Supervisors and the community at large on ongoing activities at Diablo Canyon. I'd also like to commend the previous report to the county by Mr. Alsup and Ms. Van Buren regarding our emergency response capabilities here. This community is very well served by that professional staff and the staff from all the disciplines here in the county. And, of course, we are very grateful for the very collaborative and effective working relationship we have with them. This is just an overview of what I'm going to cover today. First, talk about some actions that have been taken in the past year that have already been implemented at the station. Then get into the ongoing and very near-term important regulatory developments that are occurring as we speak this week, coming out of Washington, and then also to cover future actions that will be the result of those regulatory developments. And certainly I welcome any questions you may have along the way, and will do my best to answer them. last time I was here, I talked about some of the actions that were underway. We did create a team to really promptly and thoroughly evaluate the lessons learned from the Fukushima experience personnel as well. A big piece of this is having in place in the nearer term the capability to deal with significant contingencies on a multi-unit basis versus on a single unit at a time basis, which was the previous expectation. Just jumping ahead a little bit, there is a whole other layer of additional equipment that is yet to be purchased, much of which is on order now. Again, very similar in terms of additional generators, pumps, hoses, and attachments, and that's all associated with being ready to implement new regulatory requirements that are coming at us. Shown here is some pictures of this is material that has already been procured and is on site. By the way, it is stored, a lot of this, in diverse locations, so it's not all vulnerable to any particular scenario that one could imagine. But a fair amount of it is located up on top of the hill at the 315-foot elevation up by the storage ponds, which we showed to you last time I was here. There's electrical generators. These are relatively small ones. We've also purchased one large one that's capable of supplying 480-volt loads. This piping that is displayed here, this is material that in our previous thinking would have been mustered to the site from off-site facilities. We've since decided to purchase it and quite a bit of it and bring it on-site so it's more readily available and we don't have to have concerns about transportation. and a large series of pumps, which is, it's hard to see in this picture, but that's what's displayed in the lower right-hand corner. A lot of this equipment is designed to be able to be used to replace the safety systems at the plant that would provide the pathway for the ultimate heat sink for the station. On the next slide is just sort of a summary of some of the ongoing activities that we're involved with the county in terms of collaboration. This was very well covered by the previous presentation, so I will just say that we've been very thankful for that effort and have been working very effectively with our county partners. Okay, just last week, the process for the new orders and regulations to come out from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has really progressed to the next stage. We are in the process this week of receiving new orders and letter requirements from the regulator. And on this slide is really sort of a highlight of the key subjects that are the content, the important content of these regulations. Now, these are the Tier 1 recommendations that came out of the initial task force report on the Fukushima accident. And these recommendations, the Tier 1s, are at the front of the line. They're the ones that are going to provide 95% of the safety benefit enhancement to the industry in this country. So the first topic is seismic walkdowns and hazard evaluation. So this is two pieces. One is to do a thorough additional walkdown in the station to verify the extent and the robustness of the features that exist at the station. The second part, the hazard evaluations, is something that has been ongoing for years at Diablo Canyon, but will be a new activity for most power plants in this country that don't have an ongoing seismic safety program like we have. And they will be evaluating, significant changes to the seismic hazard for the eastern and central U.S. plants. Similar activity for flooding. Flooding here in this case can be caused by, obviously, tsunamis as a source, but that is not the only source. Breaks of large pipes, cooling water pipes in the power plants, internal sources of flooding, and the impacts are also a subject of the new regulations. The next piece is extended station blackout coping capability. This is what that third layer of new equipment is largely going to be designed to address. This is looking at how long can we properly cool the cores in the plant and maintain the stations in a safe condition without any AC power, whether it's provided by emergency on-site diesel generators or by redundant off-site sources. And our intention here is to provide new strategies and equipment necessary to go well beyond the previous regulatory requirements. The mitigating strategies for beyond design basis events, that equipment will be in place to not only address extended losses of off-site power or all AC power, but also loss of DC power, loss of the ultimate heat sink, loss of any function that really one can imagine. And the intention here is to use flexible and diverse equipment so that we don't depend on the old thinking in terms of the design of the station and assume certain things will work, but is really to think about what if that next layer doesn't work, what if the layer after that doesn't work, what are the additional layers of protection that can be provided. The last two areas here, emergency prepared going seismic studies for the station. Yet to happen is the completing of the permitting of the high-energy offshore studies. We look forward to certain milestones, which are on the slide, being accomplished. These studies will inform the seismic hazards updates that we will be doing for Diablo Canyon and our enhancement to the work that we have already done. As you're aware, we submitted a shoreline fault report over a year ago to the NRC, which was part of our ongoing updated program. The NRC is nearing completion of their review of that report. And once we complete these studies, we hope to finish data collection by the end of this year. We will provide another update of that hazard evaluation. And that will result in important information being provided to the county for their dam safety efforts and other infrastructure needs. Following the new regulatory requirements. Now, there will be substantial additional modifications made to the station. There's no question about that. There will be new connections placed into various systems, electrical and hydraulic systems, to accommodate the additional layers of temporary and portable equipment. We intend to modify the main coolant pump seal design for the station to go to a very low leakage seal design, and there will be a series of other similar modifications, some of which we talked about a moment ago regarding the spent fuel pool. All the Tier 1 recommendations are expected to be fully implemented within 5 years of when the accident happened at Fukushima. This will be a significant challenge for the industry as a whole. But nonetheless, that is the plans and expectations, and we really want to get most of the safety benefit in the first couple of years. There are two other tiers of recommendations from the NRC that are undergoing further study by the regulator, Tier 2 and Tier 3, and so that might be a good topic of future discussion once that system and that process progresses. Finally, I would like just to cover a few more points. First, I just want to make sure you understand we are happy and we believe it is very fruitful for us to make periodic updates and welcome an opportunity to return as often as required to make sure both you and the public are well informed about what's happening out at Diablo Canyon. And along those same lines, I invite you all, there's an open invitation for you to come visit our facility. We have ramped up substantially our efforts for public transparency around our operations. Increased public tours. We've had about 2,300 people out to the station within the last year. And third, I just want to emphasize to you all that we do not take anything for granted in terms of our obligation and the expectations for the safety of our operations at the power plant. You know, we're very passionate about this. We are very committed to doing the right thing for the safety of our operations and for the safety of this community. And you have my personal commitment to you as elected officials in that regard. Again, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to provide you this update, and I welcome any questions you might have.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Conway. I do have some questions from colleagues. First, though, since it's near the end of your presentation, could you speak just briefly to the tiers 2 and 3 that you mentioned? You said that would be something that would come along in the future. What do those look like, and what, in other words, what are they going to contain, what kind of information, and what's your estimated timeline on Tiers 2 and 3?
Well, there's really two things going on there. One is Tier 2s are recommendations that the regulator does anticipate that will eventually result in some new direction to the industry, but they have more technical work to do to get the content of those correct. Tier 3 are even further out. Those are ones that require more study to determine even whether or not they're warranted to be implemented at some point in time. Mm-hmm. Perhaps some examples, I guess, would be the best way to talk about that. Perhaps additional enhancements and changes to the emergency preparedness rules, the emergency planning rules for the whole country are in that bucket of items. The communications is something we know we should and can augment now, so that's in Tier 1. But there are additional studies, staffing studies, about how many people should we have at the station round the clock to best deal with these beyond design basis scenarios is a big piece. Mm-hmm. There's a question about containment venting designs, especially for boiling water reactors, which does not apply to us. There is a Tier 1 recommendation on that for boiling water reactors. But then the question down the road is there a corollary similar opportunity for improvement for pressurized water reactors like Diablo Canyon around containment venting?
I see.
So those are a couple of these examples. But these are not, again, I think it's very important for everybody to understand the most important issues from a safety benefit standpoint
or other natural disaster.
Well, the reason there isn't a clear preference right now between dry fuel storage and storage inside the facility is that the safety, what is the safest configuration is a matter of opinion and, frankly, is a matter of which scenario we want to talk about providing a threat to the spent fuel. So there isn't a clear, in my opinion, and I think this is shared generally throughout the regulatory entities in Washington, right thing to do next. Of course, I believe, we believe as a company, and the industry believes the most important thing is for the federal government to live up to its responsibilities to eventually take delivery of the fuel from the site, and there's important work going on in that regard, and Senator Feinstein's very have a very active role in that. But in the meantime, we are continuing to move fuel into dry storage at the station. In fact, there's an active campaign happening right now that we're about three-quarters of the way through for this year. We're going to take a very methodical and thoughtful way of approaching that going forward. We don't currently have plans to do any massive acceleration of that, but to continue campaigns every year or so to move steadily forward. Having some very old fuel in the fuel pool is actually a safety benefit in some regards, because it becomes a heat sink instead of a heat source like the more recently rejected fuel. And the fact of the matter is, most of the heat, okay, in the spent fuel pool that's generated is from the bundles that are most recently rejected from the reactor and can't go into dry storage right now anyway.
I realize it's a highly technical issue that involves lots of parameters here. I guess based on your early comments in that segment, though, is this a matter of active consideration at the regulatory level? I mean, is this something that And we're a little bit we're off on the edge of the topic for today, which is, you know, emergency evacuation plans. But I think reducing risk is a fundamentally important issue, and this to me seems to rise to the highest level of concern.
It seemed to initially, and now it is not at that level based on what really happened and we know now, and based on the ongoing study of the issue. So I might just highlight for members of the public, you know, the spent fuel pools at the boiling water reactors in Japan are at an elevate, you know, at the top of the reactor buildings. It's, we are a completely different design. They're not even in the same building. Mm-hmm. At our facilities, they're more remote and in a separate structure and not elevated high above the ground. So there are important physical differences there as well that really make the decision-making a little different.
Sure. Again, a complex thing. And to just end by saying that knowing that it's an issue with the public here, we'd appreciate any, you know, channel of communication between this board and thus the public on advances and evolution of thinking on this matter.
Be happy to
keep
do
in
that.
Touch. Thanks so
Absolutely.
Much.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Supervisor Gibson. Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to follow up, if I could, on Supervisor Gibson had touched on some of the points that I wanted to ask about as well, Mr. Conway, and while, as he pointed out, it's sort of on the periphery of the actual topic that we're spending time on, we have heard, as is the nature of any incident that involves nuclear power, a variety of questions come up, and so the questions that have come up to us from the public about the density of the spent fuel pools is one that I think that we're hearing more about. If in fact you mentioned, I mean, it's kind of a paradox here, because you mentioned the federal government. At the same time, we know the federal government has failed to essentially enact a policy to take the spent fuel away from the communities with the reactors. And in fact, utilities, I believe, including your own, has sued the federal government in order to recoup costs for the casks and other storage-related activities. So I'm not sure how much confidence we want to have right now in that part of this process. So I guess the question is, if we are storing a higher density of the fuel, of the spent fuel rods and their assemblies than had originally been planned, how is that being evaluated in the sort of short-term and long-term strategies in just general safety? Because I think we would have to admit that hoping for a resolution anytime soon from the federal government is the most extreme sort of wishful thinking, I guess we might say. And so it's incumbent upon you and incumbent upon us to ask questions of you. What are the longer term strategies in reducing the density? And you know, if there aren't short term plans on accelerating the storage, and I know that there are technical reasons, as you explained, why assemblies don't immediately go into the casks. What are there longer-term strategies that you're looking at?
Yes. as you're probably aware, I'm not sure. That is really the way that I believe the fuel will start to exit the facility at Diablo Canyon and other places around the country, within the next 10 to 15 years. It's a long pull to get to the permanent repository, but certainly regional centralized storage can be achieved within that time frame. Our plans, of course, our spent fuel pools are designed and licensed to hold a certain amount of fuel in them today. That has not changed in many years for Diablo Canyon, not since I've been with the company, which is almost 5 years. And so we're living with requirements that have been in place for quite some time. What has changed is that we have started moving some of that fuel into dry storage on site. We do have plans for being able to store sufficient fuel there to last through the current license of the plant and the possibility of a renewed license for additional 20 years. Some of that will require an expansion of the storage facility that we have, but that's been part of the original design for the station. And how much of that we'll end up needing to use will depend on the speed, primarily of the federal government's, taking custody of the fuel. So I think we would be happy to come back and provide a more technical discussion of the safety pros and cons of dry fuel storage versus inside the facility. It is interesting because there's not only accident considerations, there's security and hostile action considerations which come into play as well.
Yeah, I think that would be interesting, actually. Just a couple of follow-ups, if I could, Mr. Conway.
Sure.
So you're suggesting, hopefully, that the interim measure recommended by the Blue Ribbon Commission would be that some of the spent fuel would be stored in interim fashion within the next 10, 15 years?
10 to 20 years, I think, is a reasonable expectation. I will not try and handicap the probability of particular schedule for the federal government, but I think there's a lot of interest, not just here locally, but across the country, in the government finally moving forward. And at that point in time, they can take title to the fuel at that facility as well.
And have they also examined the transportation plans for removing such? And has the plant also? I guess the Department of Transportation would ultimately be responsible for the plans. The last time we looked at the plans that were meant, I guess, designed for a permanent removal, I don't know that there was a great level of confidence in those plans. I don't know if those would change or have they changed.
The Blue Ribbon Commission recognized transportation as a very important aspect of this whole thing and has a series of recommendations about how to go about within a collaborative way, both with local communities at the storage locations and along the transportation routes, a process to come up with and agreed to versus a sort of mandated, heavy-handed mandated approach to how to do this in a way that garners public trust as opposed to sort of being behind a cloak. And that's really, I think, what is going to be successful eventually.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Conway. And I will note, too, that in the last, certainly the last year or so, whenever I've had questions, PG&E has been very good in making sure an officer of the company is available to respond. So we do appreciate that.
Yes. Supervisor Teixeira.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Patterson. Mr. Conway, first of all, I'd like to thank you for your time and your professionalism and the resources that you bring from PG&E to explain all this to us and the public. My question is around the personnel you talked about at the first part of your presentation about the new team that was created to look at what happened at Fukushima and the different things. What's the breadth and the depth of this team? Who's involved? Is it PG&E only, or we got county people, state people, government people involved in this, if you might?
Yes, I'd be happy to sort of sketch that out. Well, we have a director level, a very senior person in the management team dedicated to this whole effort at our station, and that's not unusual across the other facilities in our country, frankly. The primary technical disciplines within that team are engineering, both seismic safety and structural, mechanical, and electrical disciplines, because of the systems and structures involved, and also the operational thought process, the operational decision-making. Senior reactor operator licensed, very 20, 30-year veterans of the operation of the facility are very important to that effort. beyond our team on our site, we are collaborating with our STARS partners. Those are the Western large pressurized water reactor plants that we have a formal alliance with to share engineering expertise and capability and thought processes about what are the best strategies on how to deal with the situations. And frankly, as part of that alliance, we are entertaining a bigger alliance with a large yet-to-be-named reactor manufacturer.
And I'm assuming that's both off-site and on-site. And I'm wondering if you could explain a little bit about your preparation on-site and how you utilize other resources, state and county resources, emergency safety organizations to work with PG&E and your own on-site personnel to really coordinate activities. Say there is an incident at the plant where you need support services from outside. How is that all practiced, if you will?
Well, that's quite an extensive discussion. I'll try and summarize sort of the basic building blocks, if you will. I think first, one of the most important things that we do is every week in our training facility, operating shifts that rotate around the clock at the station, every 6 weeks they spend 1 week in the training building, part of which is in the control room simulator in the training building. So every week we are running scenarios on licensed operators in the simulator, including classification of the emergency event that we drill them on. We don't drill them on sort of hot, straight, normal operations for very long. It's mostly around casualties and exercising those procedures and their skills. And that includes a limited degree, but nonetheless an important part of the emergency response plan and simulating off-site communications on occasion and proper classification and escalation of the event. So that's happening weekly at the station. And we report the results of that to the NRC as part of our performance indicator for our emergency plan effectiveness. Beyond that, we have other layers of training, not just for the operators, but for the maintenance personnel, for the professional support staff, the radiological staff, the engineering staff, et cetera. They have annual requirements in terms of training. Tabletop exercises, we have the same thing for security-related events, you know, and situations and sort of active exercises there as well. And then we have a series of larger-scale emergency plan exercises that we do, which have varying degrees of involvement with off-site agencies, including the county and state and federal, and the largest of which is the ones that were described earlier today, the annual exercise, the annual every other year graded exercise, and the less frequent but even larger activity. So there's many layers, if you will, of practice and exercises happening. And Tracy could probably answer any more detailed questions if that's not specific enough for you.
Well, I'm curious, do you actually bring emergency services from the county on site to train with your personnel on site?
Yes. The most, frequent ones that are involved would be the fire folks and the local law enforcement. Then, of course, the bigger drills, there's, you know, the federal players and state players involved as well.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Vardis, did you want to follow up with that? I think the mic, there's a little toggle there.
There, is that better?
Perfect.
Okay.
Thank you.
So specifically, our security department works very closely with local law enforcement agencies. The lead law enforcement agency that would respond on site is the sheriff's department, mm-hmm. and they have both tactical training that they participate in, and they did a most recent one in October, which I can't give specific details, but it was very well responded to by the offsites, including officers from multiple city departments, not just the sheriff's department, on tactical operations for a hostile event at the power plant. In addition, this past year we had both a tabletop and a full scope exercise where we brought offsite response from fire and law enforcement together to work through some of the issues that may arise if we had an event on site in addition to a off-site component with potentially a radiological release. And we found a lot of good lessons learned out of there and a lot of changes that we need to make. And we're slowly, methodically working towards those changes, and then it'll culminate in an actual evaluated drill on how we actually do that. And as a reminder, we do a lot of fire training on site for normal day-to-day operations, and part of our June 23rd alert in 2010, we actually had CAL FIRE on site doing training on ventilation at the same time that we actually ended up having an emergency where they needed to come in and ventilate our building.
If I could add to that, Supervisor Patterson. Thank you. If I could add to that, Supervisor Patterson, there are a number of operational issues that go beyond the scope of our emergency planning aspect here, but basically the day-to-day where the rubber meets the wheel type of response issues that that come up over the years, and a particular example is with the APCD and this plume monitoring aspect was something that went on for a number of years, and that wasn't a simple task. That cost PG.
Appreciate you being here and educating us on activities that are underway and accomplishments you've made since your last update. We do have some requests, a couple from members of this public. I will open it to public comment. And again, thank you, and give you the opportunity if you want to respond to any of the public comment. You're certainly welcome to do that. Public comment, I have requests to speak from David Weissman as well as Eric Greening. There may be more.
Okay.
Mr. Weissman.
Good morning, Mr. Patterson and Commissioners. David Weissman, Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility, and I would like to address the issue this morning on the issues of emergency planning and response. Thank you for your presentations. And to mention that, you know, for all of the items that we've heard today, there is something, and Mr. Alsop just put it recently, in terms of $1 million, $2 million, money going up, and when he says that, it cost PG&E. Actually, no, it cost us, the ratepayers. We're the ones who actually pay for the response, for the emergency response. We're the ones who pay the budget for the entire program that's necessary to support responding to a nuclear emergency. And we really don't know or can't quantify very well what these costs are. Principal among them, and Mr. Patterson brought this up earlier when he asked about these Tier 2 and Tier 3 recommendations, that what would it cost if the county and the state had to expand our emergency planning from the 10-mile zone, or 18 miles as it might be in this county, to the 50 miles that was recommended after Fukushima, to which, by the way, the NRC has not retracted the statement by Elliot Brenner, their spokesman, who said, in an accident of this magnitude, were this to have happened on the scale in the United States, 50-mile evacuation we're referring to, that is what we'd still be looking at today. So that is a question that is up in the air and needs to be discussed. And what would that cost the state of California? What degree of preparedness, what degree would be required in terms of communications and upgrades? Now, in San Luis, being principally seemingly rural, it may not be as big an issue as San Onofre, where 18 million people live in a densely packed area within 50 miles. Nevertheless, we've got an agriculture industry. We've got downwind farms through the Santa Maria Valley and north through the Salinas Valley that might need more inspection, monitoring, agricultural. So what we'd like to do is ask this board to support in asking our state assembly and senator legislation that we have written, and it has been through the legislative analyst's office, and we'll have it posted on our website this afternoon, that would really a bill requiring the appropriate California emergency agencies to analyze and quantify the costs, risks, and vulnerabilities to the state if California found it necessary to expand its emergency planning and evacuation zones for a release from the 10-mile limit, or in this case locally 18-mile limit, of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission currently to the 50-mile limit that it had declared for U.S. nationals in Japan. We think that we should know at least the cost involved in this, because it is something the ratepayers would ultimately have to pay. And although the federal government may kick the can as a Tier 2 or Tier 3 recommendation several years down the road, we think that Californians, particularly those living in seismically vulnerable nuclear zones, can't afford to kick that can down And since the agency itself doesn't know who's going to pay the bill and the liability is limited, we deserve to know the price we'd be asked to pay. So support, please, this legislation that we are going to propose and ask our Assembly and Senator to do so. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Wiseman. Eric Greening, followed by Steve McGrath.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and first, I agree with the previous speaker, and if it's something you need to agendize under the Brown Act, then agendize it for the first opportunity. Obviously, one of the big lessons of Fukushima was protracted duration of emissions and protracted duration of discovery of new hot spots, sometimes at considerable distance, and protracted uncertainties among the people as emissions continued and as new discoveries were made. And as you know, I have an abiding concern with relying on shelter in place for anyone if it's going to turn out to be for a longer duration than the tabletop exercises so far held. So I have a question about what is the plan for subsequent evacuation of people who have been sheltered in place and turn out to be in a severely contaminated area? How will they be gotten out of there? And because the emergency could develop faster than the evacuation time from a specific, we don't want people to be just hostages in their homes as they run out of food and their tap water gets radioactive. But for places where they haven't been working for a while, places that have been deteriorating from lack of hands-on care by the agriculturalists, and from the perception of products coming from this county, from whence would the compensation come? Same thing applies to our tourism industry. The two biggest industries we have are economically vulnerable to any bad thing happening at that plant. People don't buy agricultural products from and don't visit to. Lots of other questions, but all of them have duration, ongoing duration at their root. That's a lesson of Fukushima. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Steve McGrath, followed by Leeson Bonnier.
Thanks, Chairman Patterson, Board of Supervisors. Thanks to OES and PG&E for giving us this update and the opportunity for the public to participate. And as Ron mentioned, Port San Luis was one of the highlighted areas noted by NOAA at the onset of the tsunami. And I think it's true to say that the benefits of good weather and a low tide at the time of that occurrence cannot be underestimated. And I also appreciate from Ron, too, the awareness and appreciation of the debris field and the impacts that that might have on California, even though it seems that it may be more of an impact in Washington and Oregon states. I want to make sure, that too, that as we think about emergency preparedness and response, that the opportunities for water-based activities, both pre and post, are not overlooked, that we do have certain ingress and egress situations and constraints around that plant, and the water-based opportunities may become increasingly important. And currently, the port suffers from annual sedimentation that's beyond the capabilities of the Harbor District to mitigate those impacts that affect the usability of the harbor facilities, and we thank SLOCOG for adopting a policy position that supports the Harbor District in its efforts to get the feds to take some responsibility for the development of a navigable channel at the Harbor District. This is an effort that the Harbor District will continue to make, and we'll look at all the options to increase the usability of our launch facilities, from the federal dredging to capital improvements to our launch facilities. And we look forward to continue to working with the feds, with state regulators and legislators, as well as our local partners, OES and PG&E, in improving the Harbor District's emergency preparedness and response capabilities And I also can't underestimate either the value of the training that we receive through OES and PG&E that allows us to be an effective partner during these drills. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. My final request to speak, Lisa Bonnier. Ms. Bonnier.
Good morning, supervisors. My name is Lisa Bonnier, and I am a farmer within, I believe, the 10-mile zone as the crow flies. So we all know that humans have very creative minds. We are creative in arts. We are creative in survival skills. We are creative in science. And sometimes we are creative, we make things that we don't really see the end game, how it's going to be. But we think that when we get there, we're going to kind of fix it and solve it. And sometimes we get to the end game before we can solve it. And that was the case with Chernobyl. And my parents' farm was a part of one of these plumes, one of these fallouts. And there was quite a bit of agriculture loss. We couldn't graze animals or harvest meat. We couldn't harvest crops. We couldn't milk cows for over a year. A whole country had to pour out the milk for over a year. And it was very hard to get compensation for this from former Soviet Union. I want to say that all of this happened, but this plume was 1,200 miles away from Chernobyl. That's from here to Dallas. There's a long distance these plumes can go. And we have a great responsibility, not just to our county and our near counties, but also other states, nearby states. So I'm here to ask, what is the plans for compensations for our local farmers? I think this is a very important question. I have not gotten any answers of that yet. I understand it's hard to know exactly what could happen, but I would like to know what could we expect in case one of these plumes, or if we have a hot spot and we have to walk away from our land, maybe temporarily, maybe for generations. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bonnier. With that, were you just pointing him out, or did you have a comment?
I have a question, not a question, but a comment.
Okay.
There's been a lot of focus this morning on Diablo Canyon and everything else, but I would submit to you that let's say we do have a 7.0 earthquake, and Diablo Canyon withstands that with no problem. We've got a lot of other problems on our hands, a tremendous amount of problems. So I would suggest, and I hope that every one of you has some means by which you are prepared when something like this happens. Because don't expect somebody to come and take care of you right away. It's not going to happen. You got to take care of yourself. There are emergency kits available. I would strongly urge you to get one. I have one for my wife, myself, and in our spare in the house. We have it at all times, just in case something happens. Because I can assure you that if we have a 7.0 earthquake and we don't have to worry about Diablo Canyon, hopefully, there's going to be a lot of other issues that we're going to have to contend with. So stand vigilant, stand prepared. I would strongly suggest that.
Very good. Thank you, Supervisor Meacham. Certainly good advice. Supervisor Meacham was mayor, I believe, of Paso Robles during the San Simeon earthquake and experienced issues up there are certainly relevant to emergency preparedness.
I just want to make a quick comment, and I want to compliment county emergency staff. I mean, they did an outstanding job during that earthquake that we experienced, and then I know all of the board have had an opportunity to go out to the Emergency Operations Center when we've had drills or had another situation. And the level of experience, the level of professionalism, and the way they handle all of this, I think the most primary thing that needs to be said to our residents in the county, there is a plan in place. There are people there in the professional ranks that know what to do when an emergency takes place. So be comforted in that.
Yes, thank you. And with that, I want to repeat what Mr. Alsop stated, is that we have representatives from the Sheriff's Department, CAL FIRE, Air Pollution Control District, our Ag Commissioner's Office, our public health officers here, representatives from Environmental Health, Public Works, California Highway Patrol, and General Services. So the county is fully engaged in this process, not only with PG&E, but also focusing on other potential natural disasters that could occur in this county. And so we appreciate your attendance this morning and your involvement in this process. Any other wrap-ups from staff, or are we good? This is simply a presentation, so thank you all for being here and participating. We're going to take a short break. We will convene at 11:10 for our next item. And now? Okay. Okay, welcome back to the morning session of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. Madam Clerk, please introduce the next item.
Item number 9, consideration of the 5-year facility and infrastructure capital improvement plan.
Yes, good morning. I'll make a few introductory comments and then hand it off to
You're
Mr.
sneaking Ray. In there from the right, Mr. Buckshire.
All right.
But, yes, please open the discussion if you would, please.
Wanted to mention that staff is pleased this morning to present the first consolidated capital and infrastructure facilities 5-year plan for your consideration. This was an outgrowth of about a year and a half ago. Your board adopted infrastructure financing policies, and those have been in place, different mechanisms in which to fund infrastructure. And at that time, your board had asked staff to come back with a more consolidated and comprehensive approach to longer-range capital planning, and the result of that effort is being brought forth today. You know, in the past, there was certainly a fair bit of coordination amongst general services, amongst public works, planning, the administrative office, and other agencies, but I think that's been greatly enhanced with this effort here today, particularly tying in the longer-term perspective, having planning play a more a bigger role at the table throughout this process. Additionally, in addition to working with all county departments, this group reached out to community services districts, to LAFCO, to SLOCOG, and other agencies in order to gather as much information as possible in order to develop this plan, which will be brought forward in just a moment. And with that, I will hand it over to Mr. Marici.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Vince Marici with the County Administrative Office. As Dan mentioned, we're here to present the 5-year facilities and infrastructure scale of the facilities portion of the plan, as well as Public Works will do an overview of the infrastructure portion of the plan. So, for the benefit of the listening audience, what is a 5-year plan? Some may not be familiar with the term capital improvement plan. It, stated simply, it's a plan that sets out the county's intended construction program over a period of 5 years. And facilities are projects which are generally developed through the General Services Agency, include libraries, office space, jails, communication facilities, and other amenities such as parks, campgrounds, and airports. And infrastructure projects are those developed through Public Works, and they include improvements to roads, bridges, water, and wastewater systems, and as well as flood control structures. So what does a 5-year capital improvement plan do? Well, really, it's a planning tool that's used to identify the major capital and maintenance projects which are planned to be developed over a 5-year time frame. The majority of the projects on this plan have an estimated cost of about $250,000, and the plan will then be used to track the progress of these projects over time. It's important to emphasize that the projects on this list are feasible to accomplish and that they're aligned with known funding sources. In some instances, the funding sources are known, but the actual amount of funding may be dependent upon a future action by another government agency, such as a state or federal agency, to allocate funding in the future. But we know what the funding source is. It's historically been documented. It's been available. A 5-year plan does not include smaller road repair or facility modification projects. Those projects are generally handled through the annual budget process. This plan is intended to be flexible and that it can incorporate new information. One effort underway is the Complete Community Survey, which is a planning effort by the Planning Department. And that effort is intended to identify infrastructure needs in four unincorporated communities, being Shandon, Napomo, Oceano, and Templeton. The information developed from that study will be used to identify necessary infrastructure to accommodate future growth in those communities. And as that information is developed, we'll take that into account in future updates of the plan. So what's different about this plan? Dan touched on a lot of it earlier. It is a more coordinated approach. It involved a greater number of agencies. In the past, we had a two-step process in developing projects. Public Works did their evaluation and identified a list. General Services identified their list for facilities. We came together as a single group and applied common principles in identifying projects, which allowed us to better coordinate, better align funding sources, and utilize a common set of criteria. So we developed the recommended projects on this plan were identified using revised criteria that considered land use, effect on services, operational costs, and energy and water use and savings. A new government structure was developed for recommending projects, which was patterned after the Information Technology Executive Steering Committee, which has been successful in recommending major technology investments for the county. The new Capital Improvement Executive Steering Committee provides a similar function for capital project investments, and this committee reviewed all of the projects under consideration, provided input that helped prioritize those projects, and accepted the recommended projects in the plan. I've mentioned we used updated criteria, and this is the same criteria that was adopted by your board as part of the budget policies. The revised criteria incorporate new items that include operational cost, effect on services, energy and water savings, and consistency with county plans, goals, and priorities. The projects were prioritized using a collaborative process, which involved greater participation from individuals from a wider variety of organizations. And as mentioned, that all of the projects on this plan were accepted by the Capital Improvement Executive Steering Committee. So this shows the kinds of inputs that go into the capital improvement plan.
Drum circle.
To acknowledge that the county has a robust capital improvement program, so we're going to take a quick look back at some of the completed projects. The projects on this list are generally $100,000 or more in total expense. You can see that there are 50 projects in total, 18 of them in the facilities category, 32 in the infrastructure category, and a total of $249 million was spent on these projects. These projects are ones that were completed in the last 2.5 years. Often a few large projects are responsible for a high percentage of the expense in a capital improvement program, and this shows that trend. The four largest projects on the list of completed projects comprise about 83% of the total of the $240 million in expense. The Nacimiento project was one of the largest projects ever undertaken by the county, and that alone accounts for 71% of the expense. A complete listing of all the completed projects can be found in Appendix 7 of the plan. Now let's move on to the plan and take a look. There are 70 projects with a total estimated expense of $351 million. Funding sources have been identified for about $342 million of that. The gap between funding and expense is largely in the facilities category. Some of this gap may be closed in the fiscal year 2012-13 budget, and if some of it may not be closed, if it's not closed for some of those projects without funding, the scope of the project will be revised or the project will be deferred.
And if I may, I'd just like to expand upon that point for a moment. I think it's important because when we talk about identified funding versus a funded project and getting into the semantics a bit, potential funding sources have been identified for about $340 million. These are not currently budgeted. They're not concrete plans. However, when we look out, where could the funding come from? There are some different buckets that have been identified, and if the plan comes to fruition, that's what would be utilized. But I do want to emphasize that we don't have $340 million, you know, budgeted and concretely planned for over the next 5 years.
Do those potential sources require a public vote, any of them establishing funding districts or anything like that?
I don't believe they do at this point in time. I think you'll see later on the largest is the Los Osos wastewater project, and I believe the vote has been done for that. So,
okay. I'm just curious because those aren't always successful.
No, that's – we understand. Yes. So this shows how the funding's laid out over a five-year time frame. The cream-colored bar on the left shows about $62 million. That funding has already been allocated to projects on this list. You can see that the early years show a much greater level of projected expense. That's because there's the Los Osos Water Project, Women's Jail Project. Both those projects have been in process for a number of years. They're slated to begin construction within that time frame. As we move farther out down the time frame of the plan, we see that there is less expense, and that is because funding is less certain in the farther out years. This shows the allocation of potential expense or projected expense between facilities and infrastructure. The darker colored golden bar is that for facilities, and the lighter bar is for infrastructure. You can see that infrastructure accounts for about 74% of the projected expense in the plan, and facilities is 26%. This year, we took a slightly different approach, and we developed listings of projects by communities. You can see that there are 23 communities and rural areas of the county in which projects are planned. The largest concentration of projects is in the San Luis Obispo area. Those are, for the most part, facility projects, and that's because we have the downtown government center campuses here. That also includes the county operational area off Highway 1, as well as a number of communication projects up on the Cuesta grade. As we saw with the completed projects, often a few large projects are responsible for the majority of costs in a capital improvement plan. You can see here that the Los Osos Wastewater Project, the Willow Road Extension, Women's Jail and Juvenile Hall projects account for 77% of the total expense. What you're seeing on the plan, on this chart, is that the larger slices devoted to Los Osos, Napomo, and San Luis Obispo are largely driven by those www.slocounty.ca.gov/admin. I mentioned that there was a lot of detail in the plan. I certainly don't expect you to be able to read this slide, but this is an example of what is found in Appendix 9. It's a project information sheet. All 70 projects in this plan have a sheet dedicated like this, and it shows the project description, justification, funding issues, the tie-in with plans and the county plan, whether that be general plan or master plans. Shows expenditures, including any personnel costs, operating costs, as well as projected expenditures by category for the construction and design. And the funding sources are identified as spread by year. Where funding sources aren't identified, they're funding TBD, and this one is the Women's Jail Project. It does have a funding to be determined, which is an optional component of the intake release area. So that'll conclude my portion of the presentation. Up next will be Katie Perez from the General Services Agency, and we'll go from there.
Good morning, Ms. Perez.
Good morning. I'm Katie Perez with the General Services Agency, and I'm very pleased to be here today to give you a very high-level overview of the 32 facility projects contained within this five-year plan. I want to spend a few minutes talking about the process that we used, and we all take pride in the fact that there were several firsts in this process. The development of this five-year plan, as explained by Mr. Marici, included Public Works and the Planning and Building Department for the first time. This provided a broader perspective, which incorporated land use plans and infrastructure perspectives in determining project priorities. The annual capital improvement process began July 1 with departments being asked for the input on their projects, and we asked them to submit both their annual requests in addition to their five-year requests. So we streamlined the process, got it down to just one request that they needed to send in. The core group evaluated the project requests using the board-adopted criteria, and we also looked for consistency and alignment with land use plans. The highest-ranking projects were estimated by the architectural services staff, and the project estimates were then reviewed with the requesting departments both for scope and completeness, and this was another first. Once we had the cost estimates, we wanted to go back to the departments with the cost estimate and say, is this giving you what you requested? Is there a way we can adjust scope to put some downward pressure on the costs? The projects were presented to the Capital Improvement Executive Steering Committee, which was formed to bring visibility and governance to the estimating process, the project prioritization process, the quest for meeting some of the unmet needs of our departments, and for status reporting. And I'm going to show you some slides that kind of give you that high overview of what the 32 projects looked like. So this chart illustrates the funding for the 32 facility projects contained in the five-year plan. They are distributed by functional area over the five-year term, and there are eight functional areas, but if you're quick in counting, you'll see there's only seven up there, and that's because there were no capital projects submitted by Gulf. So Gulf submitted from there. The dark gold bar represents potential expenditures, and the light gold bar represents funding. And as you can see, there's a few funding gaps. These gaps will be addressed as projects are brought forward. As Mr. Marici said, where funding is not available, it may postpone a project, or in some case, optional portions of that project may be deferred or eliminated. Those projects showing no gap in funding generally have a known source of funding, and that would be exhibited by our libraries. They have public facility fees, reserves, operating budget, and they also have the 50% funding from their communities. So where there's no gap, that means that they've got their funding sources secured. This next chart illustrates the 32 facility projects just by functional area. We wanted you to see the spread of where they were in terms of functional area. And the details for all of these projects are available in the appendices. So if folks want to drill down and see what's in each area, they'll be able to find that in the documents that are available online. This chart illustrates the number of facility projects by community. And we found that there are really 13 communities represented by the projects in this plan. And I want to just give you a very brief example of a project in each district, just to give you an example. So for District 1, we found that County Fire has expressed a need for additional property for a future siting of a fire station. Now, the location's yet to be determined, and a more specific location will be available with the completion of their County Fire strategic plan. For District 2, Rocky Butte Communication Vault is in need of replacement, and so that request was submitted. For District is to constrain where the funds are constrained and do those that are the most critical. We have about 1.3 million square feet of facilities, and that raises the need to maintain them. Although today we don't have a specific dollar figure for deferred maintenance, we do see trends. We've been tracking those trends. From fiscal year 2009-10, we've seen a shift in our preventive maintenance work. So our maintenance mechanics, the staff who maintain our facilities, we've looked at their time spent on preventive maintenance, and it shifted from about 22% of staff time being spent on preventive maintenance to only 16%. And this is due to staff being pulled off to address corrective maintenance or break-fix maintenance. So when things go wrong, they've got to address those first rather than the preventive maintenance. Within the same time frame, we've seen that the backlog of maintenance projects has also moved. It's decreased from 25 projects backlogged in the same time frame to 11 backlogged today. So the reduction in that backlog is due to us bringing on two temporary positions, which I believe your board recommended the last time I spoke to you, so that we could address some of our major maintenance projects. To truly assess the financial and facility impacts of deferred maintenance, General Services is seeking the services of a professional facility condition assessment team. We're finalizing the plan, including our request for proposal, and expect to start the assessment effort sometime in July of this year. A professional facility condition assessment will help us to better apply resources to the highest priority and to maintain our facilities in a usable condition. And we want to avoid deferring maintenance that may result in future cost savings. Our work on the RFP will be done shortly, and we'll be coming to your board with the request for contract award. We will provide an update on the scope of the condition assessment at that time. Dave Flynn of Public Works will now discuss the infrastructure portion of our consolidated five-year plan.
Thank you, Katie. Dave Flynn with Public Works. In the appendices, as Vince has noted, we have 38 listed public works projects. Those in general are the ones that we have known funding for and we're moving ahead and are active. We always are seeking additional grant opportunities and other projects to add on to it as the process unfolds. The first slide just shows our anticipated expenditure plan over the next 5 years. You can see it's heavily weighted towards the wastewater system with Los Osos, and then transportation coming in next as the major emphasis. In developing our projects, on the next slide, we go through a process of first working with the resource management system as planning is conducted over the last decade plus, and really make our evaluations of where level severities are and use that as our guide for indicating where projects should be developed. On top of that, our functional units have developed needs assessments. Our utilities division works with communities on developing master water plans and master wastewater plans, from which we develop a list of capital improvement programs to be developed. Particularly in utilities, we have such as Zone 3 for Lopez, advisory committees that review those plans and reviews what proposals and what projects should move forward. The Nos Menos pipeline has a technical advisory committee that we look to and also assists us in determining what the needs will be in the long runs. For transportation, annually we look at our circulation studies for updates in support of road impact fees that we have for six areas within the county. Those are reviewed and with the advisory committees for the various areas and also brought to your board annually to look at what priorities and the operation of the fund balance for those different impact fee zones. Also for transportation, we have a bicycle advisory committee that we at least every 5 years, we develop an update to the county bikeways plan, and that also provides us as a resource to find out what projects should be advanced. For flood control, several years ago, your board authorized expenditure for doing a six drainage community study, which has been very useful over the last 10 years to really look at, identify, and see what projects could be advanced. And those have been welled up through the communities to look at what the needs are, if there's support to move forward with potential projects, as flood control is an area that largely is going to be dependent on the localized area to advance specific projects. The one exception, though, is essentially the Arroyo Grande Channel that we've worked on developing a master waterways plan, transportation discretionary funds, which projects really should move forward in the near term. And then finally, within our department, we will develop multi-year project budgets for those to track and assure that we work towards delivering them within the budget. Next slide. This is a quick overview of just where the work is planned for. As you can see, again, it's Los Sosos with a wastewater project. The next slide, though, would if we took out the wastewater project, where the work is, you can see it's largely still from road impact fees. Largely, that's still just the remaining Willow Road, but there are a few other projects for road impact fees that we're trying to move forward with for at least planning efforts. And then transportation structures, which has largely been funded through Federal Highway Bridge Program over the last almost 40 years now. And the county has always taken a lot of advantage in replacing bridges, and that's still an emphasis for us. That funding source, though, may change in the future as we see revision to the current transportation bill currently in Congress as called MAP 21. That's an ongoing issue that SLOCOG is working on to see how funding may be defined for transportation structures and maintenance of transportation facilities in the future. The next slide is just, again, kind of showing the breakdown of how many projects we have. Again, transportation structures, we have 13. These are bridge replacements, seismic retrofits, major maintenance projects, and that's a significant portion of the workload for our office over the next 5 years. And again, this is the wastewater project, though. While it's just two wastewater projects there, there's one real big one, so that's a lot of where the focus and resources will be. Again, here's a breakdown by community, and you can see it's fairly well evenly spaced. We have issues throughout the county and responding to concerns within all of it. Napomo still has many projects. Surprisingly, Hwasna has shown up there with four projects. Not that we're really going to go in there and do a lot of work in Hwasna, but those, again, are generally bridge replacement projects, and that's just where the bridges that need attention are located. And then the next slide would be just looking at our maintenance, because with infrastructure, the major component of it is how to maintain it over time. Our biggest investment still is our county road system of over 1,000 miles of paved surface. And typically, we would like to see a 20 to 30 life on our road surface. And in order to maintain that adequately over a year, we've estimated we really need to be going out and doing preventative maintenance on at least 35 miles per year. Now, what we would like to do in an aggressive program is have upwards of about $6 million annually to be able to do that. But over the last few years, obviously, under a tighter budget constraints, we've only essentially had half of that, about $3 million. And with that, that's had to change our focus in how we're going about doing our business. We've had to shift largely to doing more seal coats on our roads, chip seals, using our own crews, as opposed to doing a lot of paving and upgrading a lot of the deteriorated roads. So that's something that, in terms of our level of service that we can provide on the county road system, is the pendulum's kind of swinging in a different direction based off of our funding. We certainly are, you know, continuing to look for ways to fund these things either through other outside funding sources, but again, that's the large investment in infrastructure. For flood control facilities, something like Arroyo Grande Channel has had deteriorated capacities over the years due to lack of maintenance. And so now we're really having to go in there and do some significant work to try to get additional capacity, which won't provide a significant amount of relief, but at least it'll improve things. And then on our water and wastewater systems, what we're looking for there is to make investments in infrastructure that either meet safety and health codes, fire codes, or improve the operational effectiveness of the system. So for water systems, we're looking to eliminate losses, reduce our operating costs. And then on wastewater, we're looking to reduce inflow into the system, which is just additional volume that we would have to treat and maintain. So those are all the issues on maintenance that get into how we would select certain projects or figure out how to advance the most cost-effective projects. And then finally, just to
over the next several of years as we make refinements to the plan. As I mentioned, each year we're going to be the plan is intended to be updated on an annual basis. So every year we will bring this plan back before you, and we will take the projects that are completed off the plan, and new projects will be identified and put on the plan. We're going to incorporate information from studies. I mentioned the complete community surveys study. That's actually a very important component that we're going to be looking at in the future, because it addresses strategic growth issues in four key communities in the county. And that study will develop new plans and concepts as to how to put together infrastructure to accommodate future growth. So we'll be looking at that closely. Of course, we're going to continue to coordinate with involved agencies. We met with community services districts or representatives from planning, and Public Works met with representatives from community services districts. We're going to continue that outreach, since a lot of the areas where growth is intended to occur is within areas where community services districts have responsibilities over infrastructure. And so we'll continue to coordinate and work with them. We intend to consider projects which are beyond 5 years. This is not intended to be a list of all potential projects out there, but perhaps some of those projects which are critical to meeting the board's priorities for growth can be considered for inclusion as a separate section. Funding those projects continues to be a challenge, and we'll be looking at how we meet those challenges in the future. And lastly, I just want to point out and thank all of the parties that were involved in the development of this plan. A lot of county departments participated, particularly the input from General Services, Public Works, and Planning and Building was especially appreciated. And that concludes my presentation. We have, we're open to questions from your board, and we'll go from there.
Okay. Thank you all who have participated in the compilation of this plan, and I appreciate the fact that we're having conversations not only internally but externally to get a full assessment of the needs of our capital and infrastructure projects countywide. I have no questions for staff from my colleagues, so I'll open it to the public. And I, okay, Supervisor Teixeira.
Thank you, Chairman Patterson. Ms. Perez, when you made your presentation, you talked about the $2 million a year in project maintenance. And I know that talking to some departments that we've been deficit, that's probably not the right word, we've been lacking in funding to do a number of maintenance projects. My concern is if we're only spending $2 million a year and have been spending it for a number of years, as you, I understood you to say, wouldn't we be penny-wise and pound-wise to increase that amount of money to do some of the aging structures that we have and to work on some of the things that are continuous problems and update what we've got instead of falling behind?
We are in constant communication with the County Administrative Office to have that type of discussion, because we all know in tough budget times when the budget is constrained, we have to choose very carefully. So we've been very carefully choosing those projects that will meet the most urgent needs and put off any major failures for as long as we can. And so it's a balancing act that we do every year, as every department does in aligning their budget dollars.
I realize what you're saying, but my question comes to the point of, if we increase that a little bit more, could we cover more and do a better job of the aging facilities that we've got and the projects we need to take care of?
The answer is yes, and we'll have a better feel for that when we finish our facility condition assessment, because that will tell us where we should be applying those dollars to get the most bang for our buck. Right now, it's been done more with anecdotal information, where maintenance staff come and tell us where they think there are needs that need to be met. But once we have that study done, we'll have more definitive information that would help us better align those dollars with the needs.
Okay, thank you.
Let me just add to that, if I may. As your board will recall, obviously, when we adopted the 5-year pain plan, or now the 7-year pain plan, one of the intentional strategies was to do some maintenance and capital deferral with the acknowledgement that we certainly would be doing less, and there might be some what we're anticipating relatively minor impacts to the condition of the facilities. And as Ms. Prez noted, each year we do have maintenance staff and public works staff do an assessment of all of the facilities and infrastructure to look to see where are the key areas that need to be addressed. And we have prioritized those and continue to do that. You know, we do set aside funding for ADA upgrades. I believe we have over $500,000 set aside now, and we look to keep that replenished to make sure we're meeting all legal requirements along those lines. There is no doubt that if we were to spend more money on maintenance, we'd have better facilities. So, again, as Ms. Prez noted, it's really about the balancing act. At this point, we think we're in reasonable balance, and one of the areas that we'll be looking at is the budget situation improves is, you know, to spend more money on maintenance and capital, and certainly on roads. You know, as Mr. Flynn noted, roads pavement condition rating has dropped here in recent years, and again, we want to make sure that it doesn't get out of hand, and we don't believe it's there yet, but those are areas for consideration as budget conditions improve.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Buckshy. Ms. Perez, I hope to catch you before you sit down but you mentioned the facility condition assessment
yes.
that you're going to contract out for later this spring. You gave a timeline, or can you give a timeline on that, when you expect to?
We're finishing up the RFP now. We expect it to be on the street within a month or two, hopefully having a firm on board by July, mm-hmm. and we would come back to your board for award of that contract, and then we'd have a better feel for the scope of, you know, how many buildings are they going to assess, what exactly are we going to be looking for. And until we get someone under contract and do those negotiations, we won't know that, but we're hoping July timeframe they would start in earnest their work.
Okay. Will you cover all county facilities or selected ones, or is this consultant to help you define which facilities
we need to
have
a priority list of our facilities, which are the most important. I wouldn't want to encourage a facility assessment on some small underutilized facilities out in rural areas, you know, a restroom in a park, although it's critical to the park goers. I wouldn't want to pay to have that assessed. I want to focus on those major buildings where we have county departments providing much needed service to our community, and we'll look at those facilities. But we have to prioritize which facilities are most important and then go for those first.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. I, again, have no further questions from the board, so I'll open it to the public. I do have two requests to speak. Mr. Bunin, or excuse me, Jerry Bunin. Your dad's not here, right? I'm reminded when I call him Mr. Bunin that that's his dad. So Jerry Bunin followed by Mike Brown.
Thank you, Supervisor. Most appreciated. Jerry Bunin, Government Affairs Director, Home Builders Association. I'll be brief. It's a good plan, but what it lacks and what it needs to start working on today, or actually yesterday and last week, are the infrastructure to fix all the level 3 severities we have all over the county, and the infrastructure we need in order to build all the urban infill that all your planning effort is focused on. Without those in place, soon there'll be no building this decade. We really need to get those underway. We don't even know what the unfunded infrastructure needs are. To me, those are really important pieces that are totally missing in this plan. We've been looking at smart growth for at least 5 years, maybe even longer. And I know that we have asked this question countless times, and we still are waiting for the answer. Where is it going to occur, and when? And until we get the infrastructure, Nobody can answer that. So we really hope that that gets added very, very quickly and we get working on it. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Bunin. Mike Brown.
Mike Brown representing CoLab. We think this is a great job and a great start. We think that that Appendix 9 is really terrific. It could become a book on itself with some of the front-end stuff as the intro. And we think that the next step is that from the departments, from the planning studies, from your unfunded part of the bigger transportation program, which, as you know, over in SLOCOG, you know that you have about $4 billion of issues out there, which about $1.3 billion is funded over the next 40 years. But in the near term, what part of that is the counties that the feds and the state may not pay for? Maybe they will pay for some of it. But that being said, I think a good illustration was Public Works saying we need about $6 million a year to keep the roads from going into an absolute decline. It's not $3 million. General Services needs some figure to maintain the buildings. And then there are all the other things. And those need to be depicted in this, even the ones that have no chance of being funded over the next 5 years or are only partially funded, so you know what that number is. And that's an important public policy number, that if we were doing things properly with our buildings, roads, and other systems, what would we need to be able to do that? And that should be depicted in here in the same way, because that number, that unfunded near-term infrastructure number, 5 and maybe a few years behind, the unfunded pension liability, the existing debt, all those things together depict sort of what's out of balance. And, of course, in the pain plan, you're unable to fund current things. And so you put all that together and you say, now we know what we really don't have that's important, just to maintain things at an acceptable current level, perhaps. And then, given that number, what are the strategies that we would invoke to try to do something about it? We're not going to get it from the federal government. It's in huge trouble with debt, deficits, and problems. And the state is absolutely in decline. So good job by the staff. That just needs to be added and then used as a policy tool.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. That concludes public comment, so I'll close public comment and bring it back to the board. I do want to mention that we did receive a letter from Vic Montgomery of RRM Design Group, and he lists a number of items that he thinks we should consider. I'm going to it was sent to all of the board members as well as others, and I'm submitting a copy to the clerk for inclusion in our record, and also Mr. Morisi, I think you did receive a copy of this as well. It just came in yesterday, but he raises some of the same issues and concerns that Jerry Bunin raised regarding the need to really focus on filling the deficiencies that have been identified as level three issues in our resource management system. I think we absolutely ought to do that. And also he emphasizes the need to have further conversations with our CSD boards, community service districts throughout the unincorporated communities of the county, and get a similar list from them, communicate with them deficiencies in resources and infrastructures that may prevent us from developing our community plans for those respective communities that they represent. So I think we do need to continue this effort. I appreciate the fact that we have done considerable outreach, that we're working well internally together with several departments engaging in this process. I just think we need to take it that next step, and I actually would like to suggest that we hear back when the planning process starts again. Another thing Mr. Montgomery suggests is that we have greater opportunity for public input at the front end of this process rather than waiting until we have a draft plan together to outreach to the community, but get that input a little bit earlier if we could. So with that, we don't have... do you
well,
have
just,
further comments?
Just a quick one, Mr. Chairman. I was talking to Mr. Marucci at the break, and and I may have missed it in his presentation, but it's my understanding that this will become a natural part of our strategic planning process. So we could expect early in each calendar year that we're going to hear a little bit about this. I think the very positive step here has been the inclusion of our general plan policies in the consideration. I think it's not where Mr. Bunin or Jerry Bunin want it to be, but I think we're headed in the right direction.
Very good. Thank you. And Mr. Buckshot.
Yeah, just a few additional comments. And you know, I agree with the comments in the letter that were submitted by Mr. Montgomery and others. You know, we met with Mr. Montgomery and a few other folks from the building and construction cluster of the economic strategy a few months ago to begin engaging them in this process. And it was decided, you know, jointly that we would move along as we were and in this upcoming cycle do more outreach and real involvement as it does tie into the economic strategy as well. So we'll certainly look to do that into the future.
Okay. And with that, I simply need to state that this plan has been received and filed. And again, thank all of the departments who engaged in this process. Mr. Marisi, thank you for the presentation.
Quick, the recommendation is to accept the plan. So
move to accept.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded that we accept the plan. A voice vote is adequate, I'm sure. Did you get that information, Madam Clerk? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. With that, we'll move on to item number 10. Madam Clerk, introduce that item, please.
Item number 10 is submittal of a resolution to approve a request by Global Premier Development for the county to subordinate its affordable housing agreement to a U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development subordination agreement and allow the refinance of a permanent loan for the development of the Cider Village Apartments in Napomo.
Good afternoon, Chairman Patterson, members of the board. I'm Tony Navarro with the Department of Planning and Building. Back in 2006, Global Premier Development received a conditional use permit for affordable units, 40 units of affordable housing, and they also received a 35% bonus density. So the project is 100% affordable. The project also received some state tax credit allocation committee funds, or TCAC funds, which limits the amount of rent that could be charged to the households there. So, and there's a term of 55 years on the housing. So having that in place in March of 2007, the Board Resolution 2007-81 executed an agreement to provide affordable housing there on the site of Cider Village properties in Napomo. So the agreement runs with the land and is binding under conveyance and transfer and sale of the property in the future. And that, of course, has to receive approval from the county prior to that transfer of the property, should there be one. So now Global Premier is refinancing their first loan. And it is so they're coming to the county for a subordination request of that agreement. And staff has talked to both the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, which is insuring the loan, and it's a loan through the Federal Housing Administration, which is insuring the loan through Prudential. And the current loan that Global Premier has is about a $1.9 million loan. It's a 20-year loan at 7.18%. And the new loan is favorable terms, but it's a larger loan, larger term, 35 years and $2.8 million. So in the end, the monthly debt service increases by just under $100, so it doesn't really, I think, jeopardize the property. I've spoken with HUD officials and the state officials who have the tax credit allocation requirements on the property, and the state is supporting the subordination. They're moving forward with that process. HUD is working with that request by Global Premier for the loan, and both agencies, HUD and the State Tax Credit Allocation Committee, has provisions to prevent hopefully any foreclosure should the property come under some kind of endanger of foreclosure. So with that, you know, staff is recommending that the board do approve the subordination agreement to the HUD loan, HUD-insured loan.
Okay, very good. Question from Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Navarro, the county is in no way on the hook for anything on this. Is that correct?
That is correct. The county has no funds invested in the project whatsoever. The reason why HUD is requiring the subordination agreement is because we have this agreement on title. And so with the almost $3 million loan, they want everybody junior to their loan, insured loan.
Yeah, the federal government. So.
Okay. I see no more questions for staff. I'll open it to the public, but I have no request to speak from the public, so I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board for action.
Move staff recommendation.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Staff's recommendation. Roll call, Madam Clerk.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes. And our next item is closed session. Before we go to closed session, I'll open it to the public, but I have no request to speak, so I'll close it to public and ask Mr. Jensen for a time estimate on closed session.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. About 30 minutes.
Okay, very good. Thank you. We will reconvene in open session at 1:30. Good afternoon. Welcome to the afternoon session of the March 13th meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. We'll have a report out of closed session.
Thank you,
Warren.
Chairman Warren Jensen, County Council. The board did meet in closed session. No reportable action was taken.
Okay. The next item on the agenda this afternoon is our presentation calendar.
Move to approve.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded that we approve the presentation calendar. Madam Clerk, roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes, please.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Sir.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes. Okay, it gives me great pleasure to read the first presentation this afternoon. I'd like to call Tyler Parthamer to the podium, please. And while she's coming forward, I'll read a resolution declaring March 10th to 18th, 2012, as National AmeriCorps Week and honoring the Cal Poly Volunteer Infrastructure Project AmeriCorps program. Whereas AmeriCorps was created in 1993 under the Clinton administration through the National and Community Service Trust Act to create a nationwide corps of citizens dedicated to national service. And whereas in September 1994, the first class of AmeriCorps members, 20,000 strong, began serving in more than 1,000 communities. In July 3, 2003, President Bush signed the Strengthen AmeriCorps Program Act, which nearly doubled the number of AmeriCorps members. And whereas in April 2009, President Obama signed the Edward M. Kennedy Serve America Act, which reauthorized and will expand national service programs administered by the Corporation for National and Community Service, including increasing the number of AmeriCorps members serving from 75,000 to 250,000 by 2017. And whereas the Cal Poly Volunteer Infrastructure Project AmeriCorps program was established as a local AmeriCorps program at the Cal Poly Community Center and enrolled its first members in August 2010, and whereas March 10th to 18th of 2012 has been designated as National AmeriCorps Week, and local Corps members will recognize this event by participating in community service projects throughout the county. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby declare March 10th through 18th, 2012, as National AmeriCorps Week in San Luis Obispo County and honors the Cal Poly Volunteer Infrastructure Project AmeriCorps program. So, you want to come back there?
Thank you, Rezo.
Thank you.
There you go. Thank you, Tyler.
Thank you. Every day at 3 o'clock, I get 15 high fives. Through my AmeriCorps placement at the San Luis Obispo Parks and Recreation Department, I've had the privilege of working with a truly amazing group of 7th and 8th graders over the past 7 months. The hours can be long, and working with middle schoolers can sometimes prove to be a grueling task. But every time I witness a normally petulant teenager say thank you, every time a shy 7th grader confidently speaks up with her opinion, or I find a drawing that says that our program means the world to one of our teens, I'm reminded that all of the hard work I put into making a difference for these kids is worth it. I'm confident that I have found my life's work, and I know that all of this was possible because of AmeriCorps. AmeriCorps provides us with a world of opportunities, the opportunity to better the community that we love, the opportunity to grow personally and professionally, and the opportunity to make a real impact in the lives of others. We pledge to bring Americans together to strengthen our communities, to make our people safer, smarter, and healthier. And we work hard day in and day out to fulfill that promise. Since the induction of the AmeriCorps program, 775,000 individuals have committed to serving our country, completing over 1 billion hours of service. In 1 year alone, over 3.5 million disadvantaged children have been tutored, mentored, and assisted by the men and women in gray t-shirts. In San Luis Obispo County this year, the Volunteer Infrastructure Project cohort will complete over 44,000 hours of service to the community and recruit 2,600 community members to complete an additional 7,000 hours of volunteer work, assisting 23 nonprofit and governmental organizations from Paso Robles to Santa Maria. We come before you today in the name of AmeriCorps Week, to show what amazing things can be accomplished through the AmeriCorps program and how our own lives and the lives of those that we serve are impacted by the work that we do. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said that everybody can be great because everybody can serve. I respectfully disagree. It takes a very special kind of individual to dedicate a year of their life to putting others above self, to working hard in the name of making a difference, and to having a passion for doing what we know is right over what is selfish or easy. Margaret Mead told us to never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. The AmeriCorps Fellows and alumni before you today are living proof of that. Whether mentoring teens, providing services for victims of intimate partner violence, planting trees, or connecting others to the community through volunteering, each and every one of us is doing our part to change the world. Thank you.
Thank you. If you'd like to invite the group up for a picture, we're certainly open for that.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if I could take a point to also point out how eloquent and well-spoken Tyler is. She must she must have gone to Cal Poly and had good English classes. another good good student who survived my classes and has gone on to good things.
And a name.
Can you get her name?
Oh, Tyler. Well, she wants. You want her to say her name?
For the record, please.
If you could say her name, say your name.
Come on
for the
up.
Record.
Line up here. Shorter people in front. Taller people in back. Make sure.
You could learn something from her, Supervisor Hill.
I think I could. I have no doubt.
You're probably going to have to double up to squeeze together.
Wow. It's nice to do that. Balance of that. Internet blogger.
Don't
start with that.
I don't take credit for that.
Okay, one, two, three. I'm going to take one more. One, two, three, cheese.
Thank you all. Thank you all for being here and for the work you do.
Keep up the good work.
Supervisor Teixeira, we have another presentation. Would you be so kind as to read that for us, please?
It's my honor, Chairman Patterson. I'd like to call Tisha Honda the lectern. This one is to mark the 100th anniversary of Girl Scouts of America. Whereas March 12, 2012 marks the 100th anniversary of the Girl Scouts of the United States of America, which began in 1912 when Savannah, Georgia native Juliet Daisy Gordon Lowe gathered 18 girls to provide them the opportunity to develop physically, mentally, and spiritually, and whereas the award-winning Girl Scout leadership program helps girls discover themselves and their values, connect with others, and take action to make the world a better place. And whereas through the dedication, time, and talent of thousands of volunteers of different backgrounds, abilities, and areas of expertise, the Girl Scout program has brought to over 11,000 girls in grades K through 12 in six counties, including San Luis Obispo County throughout California's Central Coast. Whereas today, more than 50 million American women are Girl Scout alumni, 3.3 million girls and adult volunteers are active members, and Girl Scouts is the largest member of the World Association of Girl Guides and Girl Scouts, a global movement comprised of more than 10 million girls in 145 countries. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby recognize the Girl Scouts of the United States of America on their 100th anniversary and applauds the commitment of Girl Scouts has made to help build millions of girls and women of courage, confidence, and character who act to make the world a better place.
Thank you so much, girls. It's better than Jersey, isn't it?
What flavors did you get?
Is that better than the toilet paper?
Thank you.
What's everyone say?
Thank you. You guys can speak for as long as you want.
We'll be busy here.
If it takes days, it's okay.
Thank you so much.
Oh, Thin Mints.
Score. Hey,
girls.
Can we take a break, Mr. Chair?
Hey, did we get some coffee?
Yeah.
There's a rule.
Really?
Bring us Thin Mints and the government is yours.
Hey, ladies, if you would like to make comments, please state your name for the record.
I am Tisha Hahn. I'm Service Unit Manager for Cuesta del Norte up in the North County area.
And I'm Amanda Bean, and I am part of the core team that helps the Service Unit.
And Amanda Bean is a lifetime scout with us. So she went all the way through, earned her Gold Award through Girl Scouts, and is now a leader of two troops in our area and is continuing to serve with Girl Scouts. And Girl Scouts is an amazing organization for girls. It really teaches girls to be strong leaders and that they are able to get out there and do anything they want to do. And it has just been a wonderful growth organization. And I love watching the girls. All of my girls, I've had since I was 6 years old, and now they're wearing those vests over there. And it's just wonderful to watch them go from being shy girls who can barely speak to girls who can go out there and just lead on their own. I have girls that can walk into a situation now and they can take over, and I walk back out and they've got a group of 20 little girls all organized and doing what they're supposed to do without me ever telling them what to do. And Amanda's going to kind of do a little bit of the
this tree.
You know, it's been going on for 100 years now, and we're very excited about that. But and we hope that it continues to grow in the future. We've meshed and molded ourselves depending on what we need. We have new media information for the girls so that they're safe when they're online. And we've meshed and molded to make it more relevant so that we have more girls that want to join and more girls that want to stay in it, because it's a really important program for the teenagers of America
and for the next 100
all
years.
The girls.
Yeah, we're looking forward to the next 100.
What is the age range for Girl Scouts?
Kindergarten through 12th grade.
Yeah, but age-wise, we really will take them at 4 if they're ready into daisies, but really it's 5 and through
18.
If you graduate from high school, though, and you turn 18, you do have through the end of the summer to complete your Gold Award, which is, for most of you who know Boy Scouts better than Girl Scouts, it is the equivalent to the Eagle for the...
We have the same award. We have bronze, silver, and gold awards that lead up to this gold.
And the two in the end just completed their silver award level this last week.
Supervisor Meacham has a comment.
Supervisor Patterson and I were honored to attend the celebration in Atascadero at the Elks Lodge, where they awarded the Eagle Scouts for the boys and the silver and one gold for the ladies. So my congratulations to you. You are the future of our country. Thank you.
And it was pointed out at that event that the first woman in space was a Girl Scout.
That's right.
I have met her, actually.
I worked with Sally Wright on some projects before, so I worked out down at UCSD.
Great.
Well, thank you for being
Thank
here.
You very much.
Keep it up.
You know, I have to work on it.
I sure hope the other people coming before us have cookies.
Okay, we'll move on in our agenda with the final item of the day. Madam Clerk, would you introduce that item, please?
Item number 14, submittal of a resolution for an interpretation using section 22.02.030 of the land use ordinance relating to zip lines and similar rural recreational activities, and to authorize for processing any necessary amendments to the land use ordinance and coastal zone land use ordinance.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Giffen?
Good morning.
Lead off.
Chairman Patterson, supervisors, Jason Giffen, Director for Planning and Building. I guess it's appropriate that we're going to be talking about rural recreation activities following the last ceremony. We don't have any Girl Scout cookies, but we probably have some stale pretzels across the street. So I don't think we can compete. But for the presentation today, Cammie Griffin, our assistant director, is going to walk you through the proposal and the options before you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Good afternoon, Cammie Griffin, County Planning and Building. I wanted to start off today by making a correction in your packet on page 14-12. Is the first page of the Planning Commission resolution. We did have an incorrect title on that. We used an old version of a Planning Commission resolution and forgot to change the title. So we've handed out that replacement page, and there's additional copies at the bottom of the dais here. So this is a request for an interpretation using a specific section in the land use ordinance that I'll talk about in a little while. This really came from that we've been receiving inquiries about a series of new uses lately, and these uses were not clearly defined in our land use ordinance in the two existing outdoor rural recreation definitions that we have today. This is some of the uses that we've gotten inquiries about, and with the exception actually of bungee jumping, we have had people at our front counter asking about each one of these types of uses in the last 3 to 4 months. So just very quickly, I want to run you through so that you understand what the uses are. So zip lining is typically a cable suspended above an incline. You attach a harness and the rider rides across the down the incline. There are two types. One has a braking mechanism. Those are actually looked at by the state. Most are just gravity. You get to the end and you just kind of peter out and walk off. So that's zip lining. Next use is bungee jumping. Typically, you'll see this from fixed structures like bridges. However, in our county, I suspect if we have a bungee jumping operation, it will be more like the one that's shown here in the picture from some kind of a structure that can be moved, since we don't really have very tall bridges like they do in New Zealand and other places where they bungee jump off of bridges.
We do on Highway 46 now.
Yeah, that's true. giant swings. This was actually an inquiry that we had from organizational camp in the Cambria area. None of us had ever heard of giant swings, so we actually had to go on the internet and find out what they're about. Basically, they're a system suspended between two vertical poles. A rider is strapped in. In this case, there's actually two riders. You're winched back and then let go, and you swing back and forth over the landscape. A ropes course is usually it's a challenging outdoor personal development course. They can be high, low, but are typically put into trees, or in this case, they've used utility poles to make the ropes course. Mountain bike courses, and I do want to say that this is different from just mountain biking on trails that all of you might do, actually, on your weekends. These are actually courses set up for racing. And there's typically two types of courses. There's a downhill course, and that usually the rider is just riding against time. You can have side-by-side courses where the two riders compete against one another, and you can have a full cross-country course. But these are courses specifically set up for racing. They're not just mountain bike trails that are available to the general public. Cable lakes typically are man-made lakes, although they can be established on natural water bodies. Cable skiing is a way to either water ski or wakeboard without the use of a boat. You're pulled across the lake using an overhead cable system. And it actually makes these two sports more available to folks who don't need a boat to be able to do this. These are common in both Texas and Florida. You see a number of these cable ski lakes. And the last are BMX courses, and this is the bicycle motocross. So this is not the motorcycle motocross. And typically these are set up as racing courses with a gate that you start out at. They have spectator stands, usually have concession stands and things like that. So here's our two existing definitions. These are reduced versions of them. And what I wanted to point out to the board, where the need for an interpretation came from, was both of these definitions have words in them. The first one uses the word including, the second one uses the word such as, and then lists a number of uses. So you would think that that would mean that there are other uses not listed that perhaps fall into these use groups. The problem came when we went to go look for permit levels and standards in the land use ordinance. When the land use ordinance was prepared, the only permit levels and standards were established for only those listed uses. So although they have words in them that seem to suggest that there are more uses than just these listed that could fall into these land use categories, there were no permit levels or land use standards to apply to those other uses. Thus, the reason we chose to use this section of the land use ordinance. that allows the department to bring forward a request for interpretation. It first goes to the Planning Commission. They make a recommendation, and then your board makes the final action. And so we did that, and the Planning Commission did make a recommendation to the board. It's a three-part recommendation. The first includes amending the land use ordinance to add these uses, most of the uses, to the definition of rural recreation and camping, but to add bicycle motocross to off-road vehicle courses and giant swings to outdoor sports and recreations. They also wanted to make sure that during the amendment process that if any of the specific uses we were evaluating made sense to go into another definition other than rural recreation and camping, that that option was left open. The second part of their recommendation involved adding to Table 2.2 specific permit requirements for these other types of rural recreation uses, such as exist today for the existing definitions. They also included in their interpretation that until the amendments are complete, that staff be able to evaluate on a case-by-case basis whether any of these uses could be established accessory to a primary use on site, and that these uses as a primary use would not be permitted until after the amendments are completed. The third part of their recommendation was to add special standards for the establishment of these uses if deemed appropriate. They did specifically want to establish special findings for these uses when they're established as primary uses in the agriculture land use category. So these would be findings like they wouldn't interfere with the existing ag operations or a neighboring agricultural operation. So what the Planning Commission looked at were a series of options. So and what they chose to do in their interpretation was not take any one single option, but actually blend a number of the options. But we did want to provide these same options to your board, so I'll very quickly go through them. Option one was to determine that the uses in every case would be an accessory use. And what we would do is look at size, scale, the definition of accessory use that exists in the land use ordinance, and determine if they were accessory to a primary use on the site. It would just be a zoning clearance. And if we made the determination that it was a primary use, then staff felt that you really did need to amend the land use ordinance and establish standards and permit levels. The next option was to determine that the uses are equivalent in their nature and intensity to uses that are already defined. And this is also a specific provision of the land use ordinance that allows actually the director to make a determination that the proposed use is equivalent to a listed use. As staff, we did not feel we could make a determination of equivalency, but this was one of the options that was presented to the Planning Commission and discussed. In the end, they also felt that they could not make a recommendation to your board for equivalency. The third option is part of their recommendation, and that's actually to add these uses specifically to the definition of rural recreation and camping, and then determine a permit level and establish standards. The fourth option is kind of a combination of the second option and the first option, and that's really to determine that the uses are equivalent only until you have done amendments to the land use ordinance. The commission, again, was not comfortable with this. They were more comfortable with allowing the staff to make the case-by-case accessory call until the amendments are complete. The fifth option is to use the other definition, the outdoor sports and recreation definition. The concern here is that this definition actually covers things that typically anyone can go use by paying a fee. They include amusement parks and go-kart tracks, very intensive outdoor uses versus the uses that are listed in rural recreation. Specifically, these uses also are not allowable in the agriculture or rural lands land use categories, as well as a number of the urban land use categories. In the end, the Planning Commission felt that this was not an appropriate land use definition, with the exception of one of the uses, and I'll talk about that a little later. Oops. wrong way. So specifically relative to the bicycle motocross courses, the commission did agree that these didn't belong in rural recreation and camping and better belonged in the off-road vehicle course definition. Right now that definition just applies strictly to motorized vehicles. And this use is not allowed in agriculture. It is only allowed in rural lands and recreation. The other specific use that they pulled out are the giant swings. They did feel that this was more appropriate to add to the outdoor sports and recreation category. Most of them had not seen a giant swing except in conjunction with an amusement park, which an amusement park is part of the definition of, or included in the definition of outdoor sports and recreation. So they felt that these were better off located in that land use category, or in that definition. These also would not be allowable in agriculture, but they are allowable in the recreation land use category. The one inquiry that we have had for a giant swing, the property is actually located in the recreation land use category. So again, the recommended interpretation includes amending the land use ordinance and allowing for the case-by-case subject to appeal determination of the use being accessory, and that if it was determined to not be accessory, that the primary use would not be permitted until after the amendments have been completed, and that permit requirements be established for each of these uses, and to add special standards where those are appropriate and include special findings if the uses were going to be established in the agriculture land use category. And that would conclude my staff presentation unless I can answer any questions.
Okay. Do I have any questions from my colleague, Supervisor Gibson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Griffin, I wonder if at some point we could pull up the Article 8 on what constitutes an accessory use. I don't know if that's at your fingertips. I was just curious under what, you know, what's the substance of the language in the LUO that talks about that. We don't need to do that now. We take public comment and come back.
Okay, as part of the conversation. Are there any other questions for my colleagues? Seeing none, I'll open it to the public. Please, if you would like to speak on this item, fill out a request to speak form either up to my left here at the end of the dais or in the back, and bring that forward. We'll start with, I'll call two names. Please come forward. Jamie Kirk, followed by Mr. Horowitz.
Good afternoon. Jamie Kirk, resident of Atascadero, and I have no cookies. I'm sorry. happy to be here this afternoon. I would like to support the staff recommendation to find the zip line and other uses as a rural recreation use and not outdoor sports and recreation, and to allow these low-intensity uses as an accessory use. There are many community and public benefits to be had by allowing these uses in our rural areas. They support the county's economic goals aimed at promoting tourism. They provide the public organized and controlled access to properties that may have historically been off limits to the public. They provide a healthy outdoor activity option to kids and families. They also provide the farmer with a unique way to brand their product. In the case of the agricultural tours at Santa Margarita Ranch, which the zip lines are a component, the ag tours are an opportunity for the ranch owners to bring people out onto the ranch and show them the beauty of the ranch and educate them about the working landscape. A lot of people haven't had the opportunity to see that landscape. It also is an opportunity to inform them about the importance of preserving these types of places. During these tours, there's a personal connection that occurs between the visitor and the ranch. And I think many of you have seen that connection in the letters that you've received over the last few days. This connection may be through the physical experience of the ranch tour or by meeting the people behind the product. The important component to remember is this connection connects the consumer to the brand and leads them to become loyal customers. Once that customer identifies with the brand, they become a repeat customer and continue to purchase the ag product well after they've left the ranch. Further, oftentimes it goes beyond just purchasing that product on the ranch. It can sometimes change, and we've seen this, the entire mindset of that person. So when they leave, they're actually purchasing local products in their grocery store because they now have a connection to the farmer. We think this is a win-win for everyone. I would like to respond to one of the items brought up in the North County Watch letter. There is a statement that allowing these uses as an accessory use is inconsistent with the general plan, and I have to say that I disagree with that statement. I passed out for you to read an excerpt from the Ag and Open Space Policy, and that's Ag Policy 31, which is specific to allowing recreational uses on agricultural lands, and it even goes so far into the summary statements to allow these uses on a case-by-case basis. With that, I'll conclude my comments and just urge you to adopt the staff recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Horwitz, followed by Blake Rowan.
All right. Hi. Good afternoon. My name is Yishai Horowitz. I'm with All Out Events and Margarita Adventures. I'm here in support of the County Planning Department's recommendations to include these uses in rural recreation. The tours are really an incredible thing when you go out there. They're about 2.5 hours long, and really about a half hour of it is taken up with zip lining. The rest of it is really ranch history. It's flora and fauna tours. It's geology, learning about the different soil types that are out there and why they're there. It's very enlightening. And at the end of the tours, people are definitely more inclined to purchase Ancient Peaks wine, which is beneficial to the ranch and is definitely a primary use of ag land. On that, there's an additional trickle-down effect economically that comes from these kind of tours. As far as, you know, purchasing wine, there's people driving out there, there's people staying in the county longer, people coming from out of town, staying in hotels, all that kind of stuff gets lumped in there, as well as employees. We have about 12 employees that run the zip lines out there, and I don't know what they would do otherwise. They're all highly employable people, but they enjoy their jobs out there. I wanted to also address safety and those considerations. I remember in the last meeting and also in the North County Watch letter, there were some comments regarding that. We have our zip line inspected by Signature Research, which is a company that builds challenge courses and zip lines throughout the world, actually, and they go through a national ropes course certification, and that's what they certify everything on. And we stick very stringently to their requirements and rules. So it's a very safe thing, and I know I personally would not have my name attached to it. I own a climbing gym as well in town here, and I wouldn't put my name on it if it was unsafe and people were at any risk of getting hurt. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Horowitz. Blake Rowan, followed by Mike Seiner.
Hi, my name is Blake Rowan. From San Luis Obispo. I'm born and raised here in San Luis. I've always spent a lot of time outside, so I support the Planning Commission's recommendation to go ahead with these low-intensive activities, including zip lining and the mountain bike courses. And like I said, I spent a lot of time outside being able to look at these ag lands, go out onto ranches that previously were unviewable, just to be able to see the wildlife out there. I also work for Margarita Adventures, and to be able to see golden eagles and bald eagles in the wild, being able to fly around is an experience that most people don't get. Sitting there with people that have never seen that and are shocked to hear that we have them out there, let alone when they see them, is an amazing experience in and of itself. These low-intensive enterprises allow this to happen. It's very little impact on the land for most of these, with what the recommendations are for. And as well, it fits the agritourism mold. It gets people out onto the ranch to see, whether it's cattle, wine, to go out and try their hand at dairying or anything like that, just to get people out on a ranch and see what it's all about. People that come from out of the area want to do something new. A lot of them have seen the city and want to go out and adventure outside. They're from out of the area. Ag tourism allows that, and these low-impact options are great. It does generate extra revenue for owners and allows ag land to stay ag land as well. It's becoming increasingly hard for agriculture, people that own ag land, to stay in business. This is another option to both promote the primary business and be able to keep these lands open and available. As well, it promotes the local economy. People want to get out here. They want to stay in this area. We want to keep the money in this area as well. By opening up something different and new, we're allowing people to stay in this area and bringing people in from out of the area. We've already gotten calls to people going, oh, a zip line. We were going to go to out of the state to do it, and we found one here. This is great. We're going to come into your area and try this. And they get to learn about our area and all that we have to offer, as well as get to try their hand at something adventurous that they've never done before. So like I said, I support the Planning Conditions Commission's recommendations. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Rowan. Mike Steiner, followed by Susan Harvey.
Thank you very much for letting me speak. My name is Mike Steiner. I'm actually the winemaker for Ancient Peaks Winery. And I'm just really here. I echo everything that's been said so far. But my most important part is to talk about that. I've been out there to do it. I've actually taken friends, took my family out there one time. And it's just really a good way to tell our story, you guys. As a winemaker and an agriculturalist, that's one of the things that's really important, is to be able to communicate your story. We all love what we do, and in the core, it's who we are, whether we make wine, grow grapes, whatever ag we do. But in order to be successful at it, you have to communicate it clearly. And this ziplining, you know, tours and the ranch tours has helped us do that very, very well. I had the good fortune, we had an event here a couple weeks ago called the World of Pinot Noir. We brought in winemakers from all over the world here, New Zealand, Germany, France, Oregon was represented there. And these are all good friends of mine, a lot of them. And I said, I put a group together. And they were like, that's the first thing they thought about. Hey, wait a minute. Let's go do this thing. The guys, we went up there, we did a tour Saturday morning, and that's all they've talked about. They've really enjoyed it. And it really does just set us apart, but more importantly, it sets the area apart, you guys. And so it really, really tells our story. So with that, please support it.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Susan Harvey, followed by David Blakely.
Good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Susan Harvey, and I'm representing North County Watch today, and thank you for the opportunity to comment on this. Last week, I spoke with John Lauer at the Department of Conservation regarding Williamson Act lands and impacts to agriculture, and we talked about zip lines and things like that, and what he gave as an example is perhaps the activity isn't it doesn't have a large impact, but the accessories that go with it, such as a parking lot or services for food or for restrooms or something. And whereas this group has said they're going to bus, you know, take people out there in a van and they'll only be 11, et cetera. The problem is that there's no permitting process. You have no way to control that in the end. There are no conditions of approval. And ultimately then, if something goes well beyond what they have stated they'll do, you are have kind of a sticky enforcement problem, in our opinion. The other problem that we have with this is that with this interpretation of the we'll just make the having the planning department make decisions on what is accessory or of a low impact while these amendments are being processed, is that you have the perception that any activity that is not covered is permitted. And so why would anybody even come to ask you for a permit or whether or your interpretation as to the scale and size, just put it in and then have the argument later about what the, you know, whether it was permitted or not. I think it's just a very unfortunate message to be sending out to the rest of the public or anybody in general. I'd also like to remind you that during the hearings on the park and rec element, representatives of the ag community were extremely vocal about inviting public onto their lands. And I think that making a determination that these can be allowed without having gone through the process of an amendment of amendments and hearings would be an unfortunate precedent also, and not give everyone in the ag community the opportunity to comment, or the rest of the community either. This isn't a suitable process for making these determinations. I also believe in my first letter to the Planning Commission, we cited a number of ag policies that this interpretation might violate. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Harvey. David Blakely, followed by George Sullivan.
Good afternoon, Board. My name is David Blakely, and I live in Santa Margarita. Thank you to you all for the hard work you do to represent all the citizens of San Luis Obispo County. I truly appreciate that. As I make my comments today, please understand that I am not speaking in favor or against the zip lines or the downhill bike racing. My son is a competitive downhill bike racer, and I've been to a lot of events that we've all enjoyed in that regard. But I am speaking about a process that appears to be skewed to benefit a few individuals at the expense of the future of our ag lands in San Luis Obispo County. I also understand that this discussion includes many land uses, but I would like to focus my comments on those in the ag zone lands. I believe it's very important to help anyone in the ag zones carry on agricultural use in that zone. That's why we have a right to farm ordinance in this county, and that is why owners of ag land have great flexibility in growing their ag-related businesses. But what seems to be happening is that in a misguided effort to save agriculture in San Luis Obispo County, all kinds of non-ag uses are being allowed in our ag zone. If this is all about what's appropriate to support ag, I look in the audience and I don't see a representative from the Ag Commissioner's office here to respond to any of those kind of questions. What has happened in the area of zip lines in San Luis Obispo County is an example of the old adage that in San Luis Obispo County, it is better to ask for forgiveness than to ask for permission. It is clear that your staff confirms in their staff report that the proposed uses are not allowed in the current general plan. That's why I passed out to you table 2.2, and there's no allowance. They are not allowed. So that would mean to me that it's not a permitted use. It seems to me that if you allow these uses, you would need to review the impacts associated with this change and develop an ordinance that mitigates those impacts. Your board, I know, has spent many hours developing policies concerning civil penalties for those who violate the county code. Yet here in this example, it appears that a violation of the county code is being supported by your staff. So a general plan amendment and its process would be the best way to bring about these changes. That way you get input from all the stakeholders and develop good guidelines to the appropriate level of these uses and their proper mitigation. As I looked at the packet today, I'm curious, where is the environmental determination on this big change that you are being asked to make today? So I believe the best way to bring about this change is to modify the general plan, review it, get public testimony, mitigate the impacts, and then if it's appropriate, we should have zip lines and bike races and whatever in the ag zone. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Blakely. George Sullivan, followed by Zach Baxter.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the board and staff. My name is George Sullivan. I'm, about a 40-year resident in the Santa Margarita area, multi-property owner of the town. And I just want to be very clear that I'm extremely supportive of what activities have been occurring on that ranch. I have attended gatherings filled with people with big smiles on their face, spending money in the town. I believe our neighbors have been very gracious and are good stewards of the ranch. As far as wildlife and indigenous species, I've seen nothing but the population increase, so much so that the state has had to place game fencing along the Cuesta Grade corridor because of the tremendous increase of road kills, not just deer, but the bear, the lion, and the pigs. I mean, there is no shortage of game, so I can't see any negative consequences as to what's going on out there. I will say, though, there has been an air of gratitude for having a controlled access to a very pristine intrinsic value that we have in the Santa Margarita Basin. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Zach Baxter, followed by, it looks like, James Ropner, R-O-P-N-E-R. Mr. Baxter.
Hi, my name is Zach Baxter, and I live in San Luis Obispo. I was born and raised in Templeton, California. And anyways, I would like to show support for the staff report. I believe that it is consistent with the general plan, and I also would like to show support for these uses. I believe they might make this area a more interesting place to live, you know, for future generations, for the generation now. Also give people more stuff to do. What's wrong with that? They're green and they're low impact, and they're not affecting the properties in a negative way, and they're not building big buildings and doing nasty stuff to the properties. These uses would encourage tourism, you know, bring people in from out of the area, bring money into the area, hotel taxes for cities and sales tax for the money that they do spend in the area. Also, it gives kids more stuff to do and might make more people want to actually stay here instead of moving to the big cities. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Baxter. James Ropner?
Yeah, James Ropner. Yeah. I've lived in San Luis for about 12 years now. I went to SLO High and went to university in Australia, but I'm back here now. And I work at local wineries, and I've been working at wineries for 6 years. And I work a lot on agricultural properties, and thus far, like, every single proposal I've seen in this sort of whatever we're doing here, the recommendation, I think would be really good in this area. And I would like to see more of these things available to me personally. I owned a boat in high school, and you know, nowadays owning a boat's $40,000 to go to the lake. You have to spend, you know, $400 filling the boat up. But if you had a place to go to do that for a cheap and cost-effective way for more than the public, I think that would be really good for our community. And just, I agree with the Planning Commission's recommendation. Thank you.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. That concludes my request to speak this afternoon, so I'll close it to public comment and bring it back to the board, first asking staff if they have any responses to issues raised during public comment.
Certainly, Chairman Patterson, Supervisors, Jason Giffen, Planning and Building. There are a couple comments that were brought up during testimony that we can certainly respond to, first of which related to the environmental review. Currently, this is the interpretation that we're asking you to make is already included as a part of our land use ordinance, using the definition of for what is accessory is in there today. What we're asking for is clarification and use of that interpretation. So from our perspective, that doesn't warrant a new project under CEQA. In the event that the board gives us direction to move forward with amendments to the land use ordinance, that obviously is discretionary and would be subject to future CEQA review. And I'm going to ask Cammy Griffin to respond to a couple of the other comments that were brought up during testimony.
So the first is, I do have on a slide the definition of use, comma, accessory, since that's the way it's listed in our ordinance. So you can see here it's a use that's accessory to a principal use, customarily a part thereof, clearly incidental and secondary, and doesn't change the character. The Planning Commission actually did include when staff is making a case-by-case determination that they use this definition of use, comma, accessory. You did have testimony that there, if during this case-by-case evaluation, that there would be no way to establish conditions. And I did want to point out that when we issue zoning clearances at our permit center, we do so based on the project description provided by the project applicant. So using the Santa Margarita zip lines as an example, that project description would include that they were a part of an overall ranch tour, that they were limited in size, left from the tasting room, that they were transported to the site, All of those things are part of the project description and would become a part of the zoning clearance. They would be specifically listed on the zoning clearance. That way, if suddenly zip lines became something that you and I could just drive up, pay a fee, and go do, that's in violation of the zoning clearance that was issued for that particular use. So there is a way, short of a full minor use permit or conditional use permit, to establish conditions in a way associated with the zoning clearance. I think that was all of the clarifications we had.
I might just add to that, if I may. There was another comment that was brought up related to the enforcement of accessory uses. Making an accessory use interpretations is commonplace for planning and building. The probably most common example we would have is defining a garage as an accessory use to a primary residence. As a part of that process, we make a call and that is accessory, and we move that through the process. From a code enforcement standpoint, there are occasions where people don't follow the rules. And in those cases, when someone in a garage example would move forward with construction of a garage, which would be an accessory use, that would then be routed through our code enforcement and building division for corrective actions to make sure that in the event that something was built without prior proper approval, that we would go in after the fact and forensically analyze whether or not it was or was not done appropriately. So that's an example of how we issue and deal with accessory uses on a day-to-day basis, and whether it was a zip line or some other rural recreational use that we made a determination that it was accessory, that same process would apply.
Okay. Following up on that, Mr. Giffen, if I may, if an applicant comes in and applies for something, in this case, that's been determined to be an accessory use, what ability does planning have to determine the impacts of that project? If it's an allowed use, it doesn't require a higher level of permitting, a discretionary permit. How do we know what the impacts are to the location where this activity is planned for? If there's any kind of special status species, for example, or if the construction of the project could be impactful to let's say, any of the environmental concerns that are raised. How do we make that determination if it's not a discretionary permit and doesn't require environmental review?
Well, I'll have Cammie Griffin walk through the mechanics, but our first line of operation that would be dealing with this would be at our permit center when initial request comes through as a part of a referral for us to do a zoning clearance, essentially. So Cammie can walk through the mechanics of how that would work.
Okay.
So within a ministerial permit, the first place that someone comes to is the so-called planning side of our permits center. And there's a determination made at that part of the counter whether the use is allowed. We look at a detailed site plan. We look at grading plans. Oftentimes, a grading permit will trigger the need for environmental review, and so we do a CEQA determination on grading. We'll look at tree removal and apply our standards that exist in the ordinance for replacement, if any exist. We make a wholesale determination on one side of the counter before it goes over to the building side of the counter for just the checking against codes. So In the case of, again, using just the Santa Margarita zip line as an example, if a determination was made that this was accessory and could be established with a zoning clearance and building permit, the zoning clearance would look at the site plan to determine if new roads were going to need to be cut. If that was necessary, then perhaps a grading permit with CEQA would be required. Whether trees need to come out, we would do all that looking at the site plan. We might even need to, in some cases, take site visits or ask when the building inspector goes out to visit the site that they look for specific things. So there's a lot that goes on even with a ministerial permit. It isn't just a, yeah, this is allowed, boom, go over and get your building permit. There's actually a review that occurs on the planning side of the counter.
And there's also a building permit required.
Absolutely.
As well.
Right. And in this case, our chief building official has determined that building permits are necessary for the establishment of the Margarita zip line. The reason we haven't gone forward with code enforcement or any action is we were awaiting this interpretation. It was part of trying to determine what to do in this particular case that brought us to the need to come to the Planning Commission and the board with the interpretation request, because we had those such as and including words in the definition but didn't have anything else to rely on for these other kinds of uses that weren't listed.
Okay, and as far as Mrs. Harvey brought up a situation that doesn't necessarily apply here but could in other scenarios where the use itself is not impactful to, say, agriculture, but things associated with that use might be. And we've used the Santa Margarita Margarita Adventure, Santa Margarita Ranch, Ancient Peaks, Margarita Adventures example throughout this conversation, both at the Planning Commission and here today. The way their program is established, it's part of a much larger wine tour that includes a tour of the ranch. This is simply an activity associated with that larger tour and wine tasting and all the rest. Is there a way to ensure that is how this activity is offered in the future, that it's consistent with agriculture in the sense that it is part of a larger experience on the ranch and in the vineyard and at the tasting room and so forth? How is that managed?
That would be part of that case-by-case determination on whether or not it was accessory. And again, it would depend on the project description. So if a use was brought in that had a large parking lot that anyone could go to at any time during the day and just pay your fee and do the whatever it is, we might not be able to get to the call that's accessory. It's really the nature of the way it's being operated that leads to the accessory call. And as I mentioned before, that becomes then a part of the zoning clearance that's issued. So that there be no parking on site, for instance, would be a part of the zoning clearance that was issued.
Okay. Fine. That answers my questions for now. Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, in general, let me frame my comments by saying I think the Planning Commission's on the right track here, and I think the discussion over the last few minutes has been very helpful in clarifying where we need to go. But as to this last question of finding it accessory to some other use that's on the property, that's really the gist of what we're about here this afternoon. And I think it's the proper place for this board to issue direction as to how we want, if we go forward with this, how we want to see these zoning clearances / accessory use determinations made. And I appreciate Ms. Griffin's very clear step-by-step analysis of the process by which we would get to that. And I think we really need to reference that explicitly as part of the record if we choose to go forward. I appreciate what former Supervisor Blakely had to say about uses that may be incompatible with the agricultural lands and what that might do for the wider agricultural viability of this county. And I, too, have my concerns as to how much non-agricultural use we're going to allow in the rural areas in the name of saving agriculture. But I think the situation here is just a little bit different in that we have an activity that really isn't defined as a use at this point. And so that's why we're here. again, I appreciate the step-by-step. We are issuing a zoning clearance, and let me summarize what I think I understand, that if planning can come to the determination the use is accessory, some other larger use, that the added impacts of zip lines, let's say, don't go beyond the environmental impacts that have been studied that got us the land use ordinance in the first place, that they're within a box, if you will, that allows us to rely on the environmental work we've done. And that should be an important finding. It's implicit in your issuance of a zoning clearance, but I think it should be something rather explicitly noted that we have complied with CEQA by determining this if we are to issue this zoning clearance. Does that make sense, and do you see where I'm going with that?
Maybe council would be better to speak to this, but if I can try and mirror back to you what I think I heard you say, is that by virtue of the fact that we have a definition of use, comma, accessory in our land use ordinance, and our land use ordinance was subject to environmental review and adoption, we've in a sense made the determination that this is okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. This is Whitney McDonald from the County Council's office. I think it's important to remember that this what you're considering right now is not subject to CEQA because it's not technically a project, and that whatever you decide now will later be subject to review, specifically if it's an ordinance amendment. And that I believe what staff is requesting is that you basically allow them to go forward with using the case-by-case determination, which is a ministerial determination, essentially, using the criteria of the definition that's already there. If it's your desire to add some further clarification, I think that's definitely an acceptable direction through this interpretation process, but it would still be a ministerial action by staff, and I think that's important to remember, is that basically what we're saying is that this is a ministerial act, not actually subject to CEQA.
Okay.
You're just providing a little bit more information for this specific kind of use, I think, through that definition of accessory use in our ordinance.
Okay. Look, so let me just summarize. Where I am on it is that I'm comfortable with the approach in general. I would note that the range of uses that we're being asked to let you consider for accessory use status is wide in their potential impacts. And so I'm comfortable going forward with it, but I think part of the very clear board direction should be that we want a very close reading of the actual impacts of the proposed accessory use. For instance, zip lines don't seem in general to have so much of an impact on the land. Downhill mountain bike course pretty clearly could have more depending on where it's proposed to be used. A BMX bicycle track could have even more depending on how it's constructed. And so I would, in terms of staff direction, as part of this interpretation, would be to err on the side of a conservative reading of what fits as an accessory use. But within that, I'm comfortable with the approach.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if
yes.
I could jump in. Mm-hmm. The commission took a shot at that. It's at the bottom of your page 14-2. As part of their action to allow that case-by-case determination, they said, based on size, scale, and context of the proposed use, its operation, and then if it's consistent with the definition of use, comma, accessory in Article 8 of the Land Use Ordinance.
Okay.
So they tried to provide some of that direction, and you might want to look to if those are the right words or if you'd want to add words or change words.
Yeah, fine. In terms of the interpretation, we can get to the amendments. I think that's useful language, yeah. And I would have another couple questions, but on the matter of how the amendments go forward rather than these.
Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you. I'm curious as to why the swings were removed. I'm sure a few people would love to put some of the supervisors on one of those swings and shoot us out there. But
without the
they want the supervisors on the catapult.
I mean, I don't see the difference between that and some of the others, like, for example, some of the ropes courses that I've been on out, like at Cal Poly. They're kind of constructed almost similar in some respects. So I don't understand why that would be removed from everything. Never been on one in a big swing like that, but I don't understand the why that's taken out.
Supervisor Meacham, perhaps for some background, it's an on the fence issue, if you will, as far as whether it's rural recreation or outdoor sports and recreation. From a practitioner's standpoint, the staff looked at it, and we originally had it in the rural recreation category along with the other uses. Then, to give you some background on the Planning Commission, when we went through each of the uses, this seemed to be, from the Planning Commission's perspective, a use that was more closely related to rides that would be in association with an amusement park, and they made that call that based on its scope and intensity that it shouldn't be included with the collective other uses. But it's an issue that probably could potentially go either way.
Okay. And I know that the Planning Commission dug down on this. They did a great job trying to come to grips with all of this. I disagree with that finding. I don't see any big issue with the swings. And I'm a little concerned sometimes when we start talking about a general plan amendments, EIRs, basically that equates to let's see if we can stop this whole show in a lot of cases. And I just don't think that that's what we're trying to accomplish here. We're trying to find ways that we can add to the experience that we have in San Luis County. So I think this has been a pretty good effort, and I'm pleased with the way staff's gone on it. I support the Planning Commission's recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham. Supervisor Hill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up, if I could, to clarify for myself, Jason or Cammie, on an issue that former Supervisor Blakely raised about enforcement issues and options. If we go forward approving this and with the amendments that allow these uses, what would, if there were problems with any of these activities at any locations where they might occur, what would our enforcement options be?
It would be standard as standard protocol for us as far as enforcement actions. In the event that something went forward and it was, let's say, hypothetically deemed to be accessory and they moved forward with getting their appropriate permits, if it was outside of the scope of what, as Ms. Griffin indicated, what would be included in a zoning clearance as well as a subsequent permit, we would assign it to code enforcement. The way code enforcement cases typically work is we have our staff go out, inspect the case. On most cases, we obtain voluntary compliance, probably between roughly between 60 to probably 80% of our cases we're able to resolve through voluntary compliance, and then the other ones, it's a little bit more difficult to come to resolution, but we have that process in place.
Okay. Thank you.
Supervisor Teixeira.
Thank you, Chairman Patterson. Jason, my question regards the bicycle motocross courses. There was a picture shown of a very intense course, and I'm thinking of something a lot simpler. We try to encourage kids to get out and ride their bikes and do things outdoors, and with the obesity problem and everything, you try to encourage those activities. With putting this group in the off-road vehicle course, is going to make it harder for them to get the necessary permits and find a location to do it and that sort of thing. And what I'm visualizing, and been thinking about this for a couple of days, is what if they wanted to have it like at the rodeo grounds where Creston has a rodeo? And you wouldn't want motocross out there. You wouldn't want an off-road race out there. But a BMX bicycle race for kids in an area like that could be in a small area. You could even put it in an area the size of this room. But by putting it in with the off-road races, are we making it harder for them to do these kind of things in a simplistic way to get kids out of the house on their bike in some kind of competitive event?
Certainly, Supervisor Teixeira, the example that we talked about and that with the Planning Commission and that was shown in Ms. Griffin's presentation today was based on a racing environment, spectator sport, BMX. The example that you bring up, we haven't necessarily considered in that level of detail. That would be more along the lines of participant sports only without the associated concessions and stands that you would see with a more organized racing BMX environment like was shown in the slide. So if the board would like us to look at splitting that option into two based on intensity, one versus one participant sport versus spectator sports, we could look at that through the amendment process if that's where the board would like us to go.
Great. I'd at least like to look at it. Thank you.
Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That idea seemed implicit in the recommendation of the Planning Commission would be to assess where the proper land use or where the proper use category was for different activities. And I think it's a useful discussion. I would tend to err. I think they probably called it right, that BMX kind of activity does fit more with the off-road vehicle, but you know, I'm open to having that considered as part of the amendment process. And I appreciate Mr. Meacham's concern about the level of review and process that a general plan amendment has to go through. But I think that's exactly where we are having to do it, because we've had something pop up that we don't have well handled within our. Within our land use ordinance right now. I just had two questions about the amendment process. One of them was your general thought on time frame for getting these amendments processed. And I know you have a priority list, and you bring it before this board for us to determine these kinds of things. And the other one, let me just give it to you, on your page, it's numbered your page 7 of 8. I don't have the 14- whatever numbering system, but you're page 7 of 8, right at the bottom. You're summarizing the Planning Commission's recommendation. It talks about amendments should be processed to this, that, and the other. And the very last line, I just didn't quite understand. Permit requirements should be added for the other rural recreational uses. What other uses are you referring to in that line?
Well, it's actually the list.
The existing ones?
This new list, so okay. Zip lines, bungee jumping, et cetera.
So you're really saying should be added for these new rural recreation uses.
Right.
Okay.
And the commission actually evaluated the long list, comma, other and other rural recreational
other
type use,
there,
knowing that we probably weren't capturing even everything with this list.
So the uses that came, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, the uses that came up are they uses that are somehow we're seeing in the county or going to see, or the Planning Commission just tried to come up with as many rural recreational things?
With the exception of bungee jumping, every single one of these uses has actually had a fairly recent question come in at our permit center. So that's where we developed this list from, but knowing we probably couldn't figure all of them out. We did add bungee jumping because that seemed to be kind of in the same vein. The commission actually did kind of tag on the, and other.
Well, it just seems to me the environmental review of particularly bungee jumping should consider adrenaline toxicity as part of the potential impact. I thought it was interesting that they sell wine after putting people in a very stressful situation of zooming across the landscape at high speed, but that makes a certain amount of sense.
I wanted to follow up with a couple of clarifications regarding the general plan amendment process. You mentioned, Ms. Griffin, establishing both a permit type that would be needed relative to the potential impact of the project to either agricultural use or the land itself. So you would be establishing permit levels for these various uses. And also developing a set of standards by which to evaluate them to determine what level of permit they do need. And that's going to happen during this process, this general plan amendment process. But I'm curious, other than what you've listed in the staff report that was discussed at the Planning Commission meeting, evaluating them based on their size, size, scale, context, how they're operated, those things. Shouldn't we have a fairly defined list available rather soon in the event that other projects come forward for potential permitting and use. Will that be the first step, say?
Well, that would be a part of the amendment process. So until those amendments were processed, and to answer Supervisor Gibson's other question, we would put this amendment on our priority list. Right now it would be not on our working plate. We would be discussing this with the board probably in October, I think, is the next time we were planning.
September, we have a strategic planning in September and October.
Yeah, it would be one of those. Let me say fall. So when we would come back to you in the fall with our discussion of our priority list, we would be asking if you wanted to pull that up onto our active plate or not. Until that time, what the Planning Commission is recommending is that the only way that these uses could be allowed would be established as accessory uses. So if someone came in with one of these uses as absolutely a primary use of the site, that wouldn't be allowed until such time as these amendments were developed and went through CEQA and were approved through the public hearing process.
Okay, but again, you've got to determine that they are accessory.
Right.
And what if they are accessory yet impactful in some ways? How do you address that?
Well, and that will be part of that accessory call. Mm. In most cases, the kind of impacts would probably end up triggering the level of grading permit that's going to get us to a review with CEQA. So we're either going to make the call, this is not accessory, and it might be that impacts is part of that call that makes it not accessory, or the establishment of new roads or tree cutting or something like that is going to lead to the need for a grading permit and CEQA review.
Well, are you saying that if you need that higher level of evaluation or you need to condition it in some way because of a potential impact, then it's not accessory?
Potentially, yes.
Okay.
I think that's, and if I might, Mr. Chairman, I think that's the point. That's the point I was trying to raise about them being conservative with the determination of accessory use. You know, I don't know that this is going to become a fad that's going to sweep the rural areas of our county, but until such time as we have a chance to get it a little more structured, a conservative interpretation along these lines, I think, would be okay on a case-by-case
basis. Yeah, because realistically, this process will take a year or more. So I suspect that we will have projects coming forward, and you know I suspect that they can very well not be problematic. I did have the opportunity to take a abbreviated tour of the zip line project on Santa Margarita Ranch, and I didn't see any interference with the agricultural activities on the ranch at all, so that was not an issue. But I could see the potential, say, for some other project to potentially be impactful, or just the construction of it be impactful. And so there needs to be the opportunity to evaluate that in some way until we get it clearly defined as to how they go forward in the future. Supervisor Meacham.
I'd like the idea of the case-by-case issue, because it's going to be very, very difficult for us to outguess a lot of what some of the, I guess, the imagination and the ingenious ways in which people are finding recreation anymore. So I think the case-by-case thing is a good way to go in allowing people to take a look at where we're going with this. You want a motion?
Yeah,
I think
I don't want to start.
Supervisor Gibson, I still have.
I don't want to vet hypotheticals anymore.
I just have a permanent request to speak in case something occurs to me.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move staff's recommendation.
And I'll second it. And I know that Supervisor Gibson has more hypotheticals to vet, so we'll let him continue on after
me.
Madam Clerk, we have a motion and a second to approve staff's recommendation. Supervisor Gibson.
With the direction in terms of interpretation as reflected by our conversation here.
Ignore that.
Direction.
Yeah.
Okay. Staff, you're clear with the direction. Okay. Madam Clerk, roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Thank you. We stand adjourned.
Giant's wings.